Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Context of White Supremacy, Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Wednesday, November 2nd, 2016, so I have been told. The broadcast for today, one of our listeners, long-time listener and investor, he suggested our guest for today's program. We are on very early, but she suggested our guest based on a video segment where she was talking about teaching and how she had an experience with racism while teaching at an international school in Uganda. Really interesting segment. Certainly we'll talk about that today. As I checked out the rest of her channel, she had quite a few different videos talking about her views on racism and even how she has seen racism being on the other side of the globe in Uganda. Now, she was born in the United States, I believe the Chicago area. She got an interest around 2010 in educational opportunities abroad. She spent some time in Costa Rica. I think she's been in Uganda for over a year now. Real pleasure to have her on the program, and I think she would underscore, most importantly, she is a black mommy. Black mothers, super important. Joining us live, you can check out our YouTube channel as well as her website. It's linked in the description for the program. Joining us live from Uganda, our guest, Miss Black Expat. Miss Black Expat, are you with us?
I'm here. Thank you so much for that wonderful introduction.
For sure.
I'm flattered.
You should be. Lots of great work. I encourage listeners to check out MissBlackExpat.com. You can visit the website. You'll see the link for the YouTube videos right there. Or you can put in, if you go to YouTube, put in Miss Black Expat and her YouTube channel will come up. You can check out the content. Great material. We're going to try and cover as much as we can before we have battery issues. Anything you think listeners should know about who you are, the work that you do, before we get started?
Sure. Well, I'm an elementary school teacher. I teach first grade, and I've been teaching for about 7 years now. And I started the overseas experience about 4 years ago. I was in the UAE. I was in Al Ain, which is about an hour from Dubai.
For about 2 years,
the United Arab Emirates. So I taught there first before moving to Uganda, and it allowed me to get my feet wet in terms of working internationally and with an entirely different culture, and just that whole overseas experience. But it wasn't working out for me in terms of the job, and I just needed something different, and I wasn't ready to relocate back to the States quite yet. I had been interested in working on the continent for quite some time, especially after my experience in the Middle East, and more specifically, I was looking at West Africa. I had applied to a couple of schools in Senegal, Ghana, and I even tried a school in Mozambique. I know that's not in West Africa, but I was just making every effort I could to try to have a teaching opportunity somewhere in the, on the continent. And so I'd never heard back from any of those schools. I had my resume on searchassociates.com. So I started to apply for jobs back in the U.S., and I'd actually got a job offer, but I still just wasn't settled with that. So maybe about 2 weeks after that initial job offer from the States, I received a call from the current school that I'm at now asking for an interview, and that they had seen my CV. And the interview obviously went well, and they offered me the position, and that's kind of how I landed here. But Uganda was not my first choice.
What was your first choice?
My first choice would have been working. I looked at, like I was saying, Senegal. I looked in Accra, and I tried a couple of places in Asia, but I wasn't really keen to that. And then, like I said, in the U.S., but Uganda, I hadn't really thought too much about it. I had some friends that were living, that lived in the UAE, that were Ugandan, and they would tell me so many stories about it, and I became interested, but I never expected that I would live here.
Wow. We are excited to talk about some of the details of your experience and how that has impacted your view about racism globally. For our listeners also to know, she is a trooper hanging in. They just had a major storm over in Uganda and knocked out the power. And she's hanging in tough with the generator in tow. So we appreciate her efforts this, for her this evening, for me this morning. For people who have not seen your channel, YouTube, or seen some of your content at your website, you are a black female, is that correct?
That's correct.
Right on. Lovely black female, I would add. You use the term racism in your writing. You have your blog at missblackexpat.com, then you have your YouTube channel as well. You use the term racism. What do you mean? What is your definition when you use the term racism?
I view it as when a group of people or an individual shows some type of hate or discourse toward another group of people or another individual in whatever way, whether it's verbally, indirectly, directly, maybe based on, of course, something to do with the color of their skin, maybe from a demographic or a socioeconomic status. Anytime the other person feels that they are in some way superior to that other group or individual that's and that is classified in regards to the color of their skin, or like I said, those other another demographic, then it's to me considered racism.
Okay. Is it possible for a black person to practice racism against a white person? Do you think that's possible?
I believe so, yes.
Okay. Have you seen that happen before? A black person practice racism against a white person? Like, can you think of a time where that happened?
Yeah, I mean, I see it all the time. Yes. I mean, in terms of just expressing frustrations or you know, a dislike towards something that, you know, that they've done. I mean, I've seen it before that we as black people have had that, you know, level of frustration where it, you know, whether it's through verbal retaliation or physical or whatever, just maybe comments that have been made that indicate there is an issue with, because they're white, you know, that they have an issue with who they are.
I see. I get, and this is why I know for people who listen to this program, if they're new listeners, I think it's so important. We start our broadcasts with the definition of racism. I'll share my definition of racism and ask the guest if she or he thinks my definition is accurate. Sometimes I'll do it the other way. I'll ask the guest if they have a definition of racism, and you know, we'll see what they bring to the table. It's so important because so many people have different definitions for the term racism, but I think a lot of times we don't share our definitions, and we assume that everyone, you know, agrees with our definition or that we all have the same definition, and that's not true at all. The real point I want to make, I would hope people make an effort to have definitions that reflect truth. What you described in terms of you seeing black people that maybe have some frustration or anger towards whites, I think that's very logical. To me, that's not racism. To me, racism has to be about power to abuse, dominate, mistreat, and there's nothing that can be done about it, that type of power. And just me personally, I don't see any evidence of black people being able to abuse, and particularly large numbers of whites being able to abuse and mistreat them, and nothing can be done about that. I'm just not aware of that existing anywhere on the planet, anywhere in the known universe. Are you aware of that, where white people can be abused, mistreated, anything? Black people can do anything they want to whites, and nothing can be done about it by anyone? Are you aware of that?
No, you know, that's an interesting perspective, and I'm so glad that you shared your thoughts and your definition on racism. And I guess I didn't think about it in that large of a context in terms of, you know, the power issue, because, you know, you're right. And us, even in large number in numbers, we don't have that same effect in terms of what we can get away with, or, you know, in terms of seeking justice, because it's all about, you know, them, you know, trying to have that ultimate control and power. So from your perspective, I can see where you're coming from. I think from what I was saying was just more from, you know, us as black people being frustrated about, you know, the actions of white people, and, you know, maybe by their thoughts or what, you know, what we think, what we say, what we do, and more in the form of out of that frustration. But in terms of a large number and being able to retain more power, no, you're right. That's something that is not existing at this point.
Right on. I point that out. I think we've had a number of guests who have suggested that black people, really any non-white people in the world, being frustrated about racism or about whites, that qualifies as racism. And it's not logical. I do try to make sure I point out the counter-racist logic of why that is false logically. But moving forward, before you began teaching abroad, did you have any experience as a teacher while you were here in the States?
Yes, I did. I worked for 3 years in a Title I school in the south suburbs of Chicago. Prior to that, I was in corporate America for about 5 years, doing various things, everything from office administration to creative service coordinator to receptionist, you name it all. And I can give you a little bit of my background to tell you how I got into teaching, but, with the context of time, I'm not sure if that's what you want to hear.
Generally, I would say yes, but I guess if you want to be abbreviated, just in the interest of time.
No, you know, the time factor is not a problem. I was just concerned about my battery, but my generator is working, so I'm able to keep my computer pretty charged for the meantime, I say that.
Oh, okay. Wonderful. Okay, well, yeah, let's hear the background.
All right. So basically, after college, I went to I did the corporate America thing. I actually had an interest in education before I left undergrad, but I never pursued it. I had the wrong intentions. I was focused in the wrong areas, and I decided to go another route, which was speech communication and public relations. So from that, I was able to get, you know, more deeper into that corporate America thing, but it wasn't for me. I just dealt with a lot of kind of some of the same issues that we were just speaking of, the power struggle, the racism from you know, both my perspective and yours, my frustrations and their power, you know, them trying to get their power. And then I in about 2006, I was laid off from my last corporate position. And at that time, I found out I was pregnant with my son. And I just, you know, I didn't know what I was going to do with my life. I just knew that in that moment, I needed to do something better and I needed to have more stability. And I knew I wanted to be in a position of helping other people, but I wasn't really clear at that time in what capacity. So I did some more research, and about a year later, I started a grad program in elementary education. I finished that within 2 years. It was extremely hard because I was also working full-time. I got another job just to make ends meet. I was going to school part-time, and I was taking care of my son, who was less than a year old at the time. So when people say that they can't get through school or that they have all these obstacles, it's not true, because I made it, and I was able to, you know, to go through regardless of the obstacles. So, and then I kind of fell into the position that I worked at in the States. There was a position that kind of opened up for me, and I was able to stay on for 3 years. And at the end of that 3 years, I decided it was time to move on, and I wanted to give the overseas teaching opportunity a try. And here I am 4 years later. So.
Wow. Perseverance. MissBlackExpat.com. Check out the website, the YouTube channel.
Thank you.
For sure.
I appreciate it.
And just with kind of what you described in terms of the racism here in the States that you experienced, racism, white supremacy, where you said you were frustrated and they were exercising their power. Was this the corporate setting or the classroom setting?
This was more in the corporate setting.
Okay.
I didn't see it as much in the States because, you know, the environment. I was teaching pretty much at an all black school. I didn't have white administrators. All my administrators were black. They were very supportive. The parents that I worked with were black. I don't even think that I might have had one or two white students within the 3 years that I worked at that school. It was a Title I school. Not saying that has anything to do with it, but it just with the demographic that I was working with and the administration, I didn't have to really deal with that as much as I did in corporate.
Explain.
And as much as I've
I just want you to tell our listeners the significance of it being a Title I school.
Title I school, you mean what is a Title I school, or?
Just why that's significant, what it is, why it's significant.
I think for me, I'll preface this with saying that because it, you know, that first experience was probably the best teaching experience that I've ever had, and I actually miss teaching in that school. But a Title I school basically means that most of the children, a large percentage of the children, are on free and reduced lunch options based on their parent income. And why that was significant to me is because since I've been overseas, I've worked with the most privileged, spoiled, unappreciative children because their parents come from very wealthy backgrounds. They have a different lifestyle, and the children that I worked with in the States, they didn't have that. So those same experiences, they were very came more from a humble background, were more appreciative of the things that I would do for them. They wanted to be there. They wanted to learn. Again, I was working with a first grade in the first grade, so my kids were a lot younger. But I appreciated that experience because it just taught me a lot, and it just really kind of showed me the true definition of what it means to be in education and just working for my community, because I was working for, you know, fellow African-American children, and I'm giving back to my community that I grew up in. Now, since I've been overseas, although it's been a really good experience, but these children, they can't relate to my background, nor can I really relate to theirs, and sometimes there's a little bit of a disconnect because of that. And so, like I said before, I felt like I had a better connection with those children and that I was really making that impact and that they, and I knew that I had an effect on their life.
Wow. So glad we got the additional detail. I was going to ask this question later, but I think it would be good to know now. Can you tell us, you're at an international school in Uganda, so can you tell us, like, as much detail as possible in terms of the demographics, racial composition of the students, the staff, who attends this school, like, as much detail as possible about an international school in Uganda?
Okay. Well, there's everybody. Primarily, you'll see Ugandans. You see there's a huge Indian population in Uganda, so you see quite a few Indian families. You have Somali families, Sudanese. You have other East African nationalities represented. You have European. You have South American. You have American. You have Asians. Of all types, whether, you know, everything from Korean to Chinese. My classroom right now consists of, I have, just think of my demographic, I have Americans, I have Ugandans, I have Sudanese, I have Russian, another, well, she's mixed with Russian, and I have another student this year with Russian and Congolese. I have
What percentage of the students at the school are white?
The percentage, I would say, I would give it maybe about, I would say about 40%. It's quite a bit. Now, in terms of the teachers, you were asking the demographics of the teachers. In early primary, between kindergarten and grade three, you have a mix of Ugandan and a sprinkle of white teachers. I'm the only Black American teacher in the entire school. There is an intern there. She's Black American. She's going to be there for another month or so. But when you get into the upper primary and the secondary, which is they're considered their high school, you see mainly just British whites. You see Australian and American white with a few sprinkles of Ugandan and Kenyan teachers.
Gender breakdown, particularly the upper levels where it starts to be more white in terms of male to female ratio of teachers?
The male female ratio in the upper levels, I would say, would be, in my opinion, it's more heavily dominated by males. I would say that the male population is higher.
Okay.
It's a very large school. Actually, you know, I'm an early primary, so I usually don't see that side of the school. I could go a week without seeing them because it's like, it reminds me of a college campus. So they've invested a lot in this school, in the school and the infrastructure.
Got it. Fascinating. Mm-hmm. Okay. How does the international school, how does that compare? I don't know if you've been to other schools in your area of Uganda. How does that school compare to, like, the elementary schools in your part of Uganda or the upper-level schools in your part of Uganda?
Now, when you, just so I'm clear, when you say the upper-level or primary schools, are you speaking of local schools or other international schools?
Local schools.
Okay, so the local schools here are primarily are all Ugandan. I'm actually the community development coordinator for a local school here, which basically means I coordinate their school improvement projects. And their school doesn't compare anything to the international school. I'm in the process of coordinating a construction project for them to have more bathroom facilities because they have over 600 students and they don't have enough bathroom facilities. They need a school library. They don't have books for the library. They don't have playground equipment. The class ratio is usually maybe 30 students to every two for one or two teachers, depending if they have an aide in the classroom. In comparison to the international school, we have computer labs and all the resources galore. Two or three different libraries on campus. My class right now, I have 13 students in my class, which is a dream. If you're a teacher, that's like the best thing, to have a small class. I've never had a small class, so I'm able to get so much more done with them. But it doesn't really compare, honestly, and it's very sad. Now, I can't speak for every local school. I've only been to a few, and the ones that I've seen always seem to lack in greater resources and and accommodations for the students, accessibility to IT materials. Everything is on the computer now. Most of the schools don't have access to that. So, and I know a lot of them are privately owned schools where the students are still paying school fees, but it's not enough to help generate a transformation within the individual schools. And then the government schools, unfortunately, they don't really have much of an option. They don't get as much financial assistance as you would think, because it's a government school.
Wow.
But the international schools, like the tuition these children pay are about $5,000 a term. So they're paying about $15,000. Now that's for my kids, which are their first graders. Now for the secondary students are paying close to anywhere between $25,000 and $30,000, I believe. I might be off with my quotation, but it's absolutely ridiculous. But because of the type of money that they're paying, they're able to accommodate and provide such resources for the students.
Fascinating. That is a crushing depiction of global white supremacy, in my opinion. I want to make sure I'm not making an assumption. The local schools, you're in Kampala, Uganda? Is that the specific city?
Yes, I'm in Kampala. Mm-hmm.
Okay. The local schools there that are struggling and don't have basic resources and even enough, restroom facilities, have you seen even one white child at any of these local schools in Kampala?
Absolutely not. Mm-hmm. No. Let me tell you something, Gus. Like, it's the white people here, to me, they live in some type of bubble. Like, they don't expose their children or themselves to anything outside of this international school community. I actually did another video on this a few weeks ago about how I'm trying to expose my son to outside opportunities for him to engage with the local community, because you can easily get lost within this bubble that they live in, this very safe and nurtured and environment. And it's not realistic, honestly. So, no, there's no white children in the local schools. You may find a few sprinkles of Indian or Sudanese, but that's very rare. There's another school that I also partner with on a couple of other activities, and they have a pretty good diverse mix, but you won't see whites. You'll see a diverse mix of other Africans, or, like I said, the Indians, but you won't see the whites at all. They tend to only put their children in those international school settings.
Wow. Do you know, what type of white people would be in Uganda to have their children enrolled in these schools? Like, who are the parents of these children? Who are we talking about?
These are parents who are high executives in NGOs. They own businesses. They work in some type of corporate. Maybe they have a partnership with a corporation that's based here in Kampala, or it may be based in another East African country such as Kenya or Tanzania, which usually is more known to have international businesses. And just they're here temporarily, maybe on a 2 or 3 year contract. Some work for the government, some work for the U.S. Embassy. There's just different types of positions that I personally seen them, you know, work in while they're here.
They just, to me, that sounds like high-level suspected racists, in my opinion. These folks that are in these NGO positions or where they are able to move around the globe and have lots of influence and have, you know, this much money to send their children to these schools. Like, these sound like some, these sound like white people who I would suspect of not being very ignorant about racism. That would be my suspicion. I could be in error. But that is fascinating information all the way around to get more detail about your schools. How much,
it is. I'm sorry. My lights just went out. That's what why you had to be. No, it's okay, but I'm fine. My computer is okay. So, no, you know, I just find it just funny how they come here. Like basically the reason, you know, another reason I put that video out there that you commented on, which I...
Uh-oh. Are you still with us? Not hearing Miss Black Expat. Not hearing Miss Black Expat. Oh no, she said she told me just before we went live that they were having a. Oh, she's dialing back in. Let's see. But she said they were having a really bad storm and she had lost electricity briefly, and she just said her lights went out. So I mean, she is really being a trooper and hanging in. Let's see if we can. Oh, I think we got
her. Hey, I'm here. I'm here.
Yes, ma'am. We can hear you. Can you hear us?
Yeah, I can hear you. I'm sorry about that. I don't know what happened.
It could be the storm. Do you feel safe? Like, do you feel? I don't know if it's lightning or what have you, but do you
no,
feel?
It's so common. You know, this is like a once a week thing for me. I mean, I've been days without electricity. I've had low water pressure. I've had no water at all. So this is nothing at all for me. Yeah, it's very common. Whenever anything slightly happens, the rainstorm, I wouldn't even have considered it a big storm, but any slight thing will just throw off the power source here, so we will go without, you know, lights. And this may go in well into the middle of the night until I get power.
Wow.
So I just have to make do for what, you know, whichever way that I can. And it's very humbling. I've learned, you know, a lot through the experience, you know, how to adapt, so... It's not that big, you know, big thing for me as it used to be. I used to have a big deal with it and be very frustrated by it. But, you know, it is what it is.
Wow. Reminds me of Assata Shakur. She said human beings can adapt to anything. You would be surprised. When you were preparing for this journey, like you emphasized research, when you talked to other black people about traveling abroad, like how much time did you invest in researching Uganda and the school there? And I mean, did you know going in that, oh, okay, they have power outages in the place that I'm going to be staying at, and you know, it could be hours on end with me not having power when these storms come? Like, can you just tell us about how much time you invested in the research and how much you knew about going into this project?
Sure. You know, I did a little research. Like I said, Uganda, I wasn't expecting them, you know, to work here, but I was so anxious to get on the continent. So when they offered me the interview, I just kind of, you know, went along with it. And then afterwards is when I started to do the research. So it wasn't a place where I initially said, hey, I want to move to Uganda. Let me do this research. Let me find all this information. So once I was, you know, had the job offer, I was asking around. I was able to connect with quite a few individuals online. Facebook has been a blessing. I'm joined in quite a few Black expat groups on Facebook. So that was really good. And just reaching out to people that have been here before, that has family. It was really a blessing, honestly, because it seemed like when I was still in the contemplation stage as to whether or not I wanted to come to Uganda anyway, because I didn't preface this when I first told you, but I left my son in the States with his father for the first year that I was here. So I was very hesitant about leaving him behind and starting my life over in a completely new country, starting over in a new, you know, school and, you know, just kind of having to get reacclimated. So within all of that hesitation, you know, I was still asking and reaching out to people, but it was just a blessing because all these signs were coming at me of people that, you know, were just kind of coming in my path that had either, you know, lived in Uganda or had, you know, like I said, family or friends who had visited or had a really good piece, a chunk of information to share with me. And that's kind of how I functioned initially until I started just taking my own steps to go out even more. But my number one suggestion for anybody who wants to relocate to a new country is if you can, by any way possible, visit. I would highly, highly suggest it. I knew about the power outage thing. I knew about the roads and the transportation. I knew about the rainy season. I knew about it. I just, you know, it's a difference between knowing about it and hearing about it, and it's a difference between experiencing it. So you can hear about it all you want, but until you're actually in the experience, it's a completely different story.
Got it. Did you know about the power outages before you got there?
The administrator that interviewed me, she, you know, she said, you know, she made a little joke. She said, you know, just as long as you can deal with the power outages and water shortages, you know, possibly once a week, then you should be okay. And I kind of laughed. I was thinking in my head, like, she couldn't be serious, but she was. Yeah. It hasn't really been that bad. I mean, I would say at least once a week, though, the power does go out. Now, the water is not so much as often as a week, but the power definitely goes out weekly.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Our listeners from all over the world, just, you know, you can take a moment to think about that. So if you had that to look forward to on a weekly basis, a power outage that lasts, you know, hours, how that would impact your schedule on a weekly basis. Wow.
I mean, yeah, I won't sit here and tell you that it's just, you know, been okay, because it, you know, sometimes this will be in the middle of me getting ready for work, and sometimes I don't have hot water. I mean, it's been times where I've had no electricity for 2 days and everything in my refrigerator I had to throw away.
Wow.
You know, and it's just, it's little things like that, you know. It's things that we take for granted so much stuff. You know, when I was in the States, when I was in the UAE, I took for granted all of that. And I've just learned to appreciate things on a completely different level living here, because, at any given moment, you just don't know. You know, what may come about, you know. So.
Wow. I wanted to make sure we included as well, because I started off saying that you, most importantly, a writer, blogger, teacher, educator, you are a Black mother. Can you talk about the process, being a Black mother and leaving to go teach abroad and leaving your child, your only child, behind with his father?
Well, yeah, sure. Now, let me just tell you, when I was in the UAE, he was with me. He was with me for those 2 years, but being a single mother, you know, I'm pretty sure whether Black or white or whoever, you know, it is a struggle. But for me in the UAE, it was a real struggle being a Black single mom, specifically because I dealt with a lot of racist issues as well there, specifically in the school systems. Where my son was going, he had one particular instance where an Egyptian teacher slapped him in the head because he was talking or something. And of course, it was my white administrators. I didn't get any support. And my whole argument was, you know, you don't put your hands on my child. But he got away with it because of who he was and who I was. And that's where you go into that power issue. Because, of course, if he was, you know, if it was a white student and that was a, you know, a black teacher, he would have been gone a long time ago, you know, without a question about it. So I was dealing with a lot of issues with his school. You know, it was a very conservative culture and all these things. But my son was just having a difficulty adapting there in that environment. And it just wasn't really working for him. So he kept telling me, I just want to go home and be with my dad. And I didn't want to refuse that from him because at the time he was 8. And I knew that because I'd been away for those 2 years that he had lost a piece of that relationship. And I'm a strong advocate for black boys to have a relationship with their father, especially if the father is present and he wants to have a relationship. So I was always advocating for that. You know, we had an agreement where, you know, in the summers we would go home and he'd be there, be with him. But this particular time he said, you know, I want to stay with my dad. So like I said before, I wasn't really ready to come back to the States. And I just thought I'd be able to handle it, you know, alone without him. And honestly, it was a really difficult time for me being away from him last year. But just being a single black mom overseas is very difficult. I tell my friends this all the time back at home. You don't realize what you have until you don't have it. So at home, I have a really good support system between my parents, my siblings, friends, distant family members. I always have people that have been there for me and have helped me, you know, just help me with my son overall. You know, whether everything from babysitting to giving me advice to just being, you know, being there for that moral support. But being here, you know, of course, family is the phone call away, but it's nothing like having your support team in your circle, you know, around you in your physical space. So that has been an extreme challenge for me. Financially, it's difficult because, you know, raising a child, you know, overseas and, you know, the income is not really as good as people may think. That's another thing if somebody is interested in teaching, especially teaching. Now, I can't speak for other professions, but with teachers, there's just not a lot of money involved wherever you go. But especially when you come to places like Uganda, you will find you'll get a lot of other accommodations. Like I get free housing and tuition for my son is free. Membership to the gym is free. You know, I get a lot of incentives, but in terms of living wage, it's very difficult. And then just being a mom, you know, it's like I always feel that boys need a male presence in their life. You know, whether you have a relationship with the father or not, a boy needs a male presence, whether in the form of a mentor, uncle, you know, brother, whoever, he needs that male presence. And I find that to be a little bit difficult here where I haven't really, he doesn't have a consistent male mentor. He's involved in several activities. I keep him busy. He's on in basketball. He's in swimming, robotics, and he has male teachers. But I really would like for him to have, more of a one-on-one connection with somebody. But it's very, you know, it can be a little bit difficult to the point where I'm considering moving back home so that I can have that support and for him to be closer to his father, to my family in the long run.
Wow. Context of white supremacy, Miss Black Expat. Visit the website, MissBlackExpat.com. With the school incident that you started with when you were in the UAE, and you said it was difficult, and you felt like you were experiencing a lot of racism, white supremacy, I would say. Your child was having a difficult time adjusting. You said that this teacher, white male teacher, struck your son, and nothing was done about it. He wasn't, you know, reprimanded or anything, and it wasn't a big deal. Did they have a policy where, you know, they explicitly stated that teachers are allowed to strike students?
There's no policy in force. He wasn't actually a white teacher. He was an Egyptian teacher, but you might as well just put him on that same category. But there was a white American male administrator who was the one telling me that it wasn't that big of a deal, and in more or less words that I need to get over it and move on.
Wow.
I was treated very, I mean, I had to file a grievance with the main corporate office of my of the school that he was. Basically, it's a school, it's a private school, and it fell under the a major conglomerate of different private schools in the UAE. So, and I had to literally go to the main office and file a grievance against him because nothing was happening face to face. But yeah, he basically thought that, you know, it wasn't anything, you know, he didn't see it happen. The teacher said he was sorry and he, you know, he gave him a warning and he won't do it again. But he wasn't able to pull, and this was something that I wasn't able to obtain, which was anything in their policy stating about the no hitting. But he did clearly state that there's no hitting allowed. Now, the teacher blatantly lied on me initially saying he did not do it, when my son would never lie to me about anything like that. So then he comes back again and says, you know, he's sorry. He didn't mean to. It wasn't really a hit. It was a, you know, a tap. You know, he's trying to be like everything. It was ridiculous. You know, I mean, the things that I had to go through with this situation, I mean, it was just nerve wracking. And here I go again in an isolated place away from that support, by myself, trying to raise my black son in a different culture and dealing with all of these different implications along the way. And it has, you know, it's been very difficult. So, you know, thankfully it was toward the end of the year. I felt powerless, really, honestly, because everything that I was saying as a mom was really going out of the window. They weren't respecting what I had to say, nor were they trying to take any further action other than, you know, look, we told you he has the warning and, you know, get on with your life, basically. Again, if I was a white mother or if this was a black teacher, everything would have been completely turned around. That teacher wouldn't probably even had a chance to explain himself before he was pushed out the door. So I really completely respect everything you say about the racist issue in terms of power, because it is white supremacy. You know, he knew he can get away with that as that white administrator in that position, and he can pretty much, you know, do what he wants and his will. He needed that teacher. And he felt that me, you know, as a black mother, what my thoughts and what my feelings were toward the action that was taken against my son were irrelevant. That at this point, what mattered is that his staff was, you know, still there and, you know, and people went on with their day. You know, and white people try to avoid conflict. You know, it's like I've seen that a lot in my journey internationally, and it's just a different breed of white people, but they really tried to avoid conflict, and he was trying to just brush it completely off. I wasn't having that at all. So when he completely brushed me off, I went above his head and I filed the grievance again because I'm out of my element. The things that we do in the States is not necessarily as deeply impacted as they are in other parts of the world. You know, that grievance wasn't necessarily that big of a deal to them. It's just like, okay, you fill out this paperwork, you know, we have it on file. Thank you for letting us know. You know, as opposed to when, if I was in the States, I would have been a completely different, you know, I could have taken legal action. So in some respects, I do feel that I can't get, I'm so limited in the things that I have access to in terms of me trying to obtain some type of power or getting justice in situations.
Right. I want to make sure I point out as well, I did snicker there. We've talked about that, you know, laughing. This is serious. This is war. And certainly it is not humorous at all. A black child being violently assaulted again in a classroom setting, and then a black mother not being able to do anything about it. But the portion or the point where I did snicker was when this white teacher lied, struck your son, lied about it, said he didn't do it, then came back and then admitted that he did do it, but said that it was not a hit, it was a tap. And that sort of thing, that happens, the humor in it for me was that is white culture. That exactly what you said, where terrorism against black people, it always gets minimized, where we're not using the correct terms, where that becomes a tap, where slavery, enslavement of black people becomes migrant workers, where you end up with all of these nonsense terms, microaggressions, where I say, I encourage listeners not to use that term because it's the same thing. It's minimizing. It's always something small when black people are mistreated, and we should get totally away from any concept or any terms that suggest that this is something minor. This is just, you know, a meager offense against little childish black people who are so easily offended and just can't let things go, which is kind of sounds like what the white administrator told you. Just, you know, let it go and, you know, move on about your day, man. Stop wasting our time with all this. Wow. I also wanted to, ask directly. You also, because you have videos about your observations about how racism, white supremacy as a global system, how it impacts the Ugandans. And you have a whole video where you talk about colorism in Uganda. And I want to know, are you treated by Ugandans? Are you treated differently on the basis of being African-American? Or are you treated on the basis of being a little bit lighter? And I guess to clarify that question, the latter part of that question for our listeners, I guess if you could pick out somebody that we know that we have that a lot of us would have seen, very, really popular person, that you can say, hey, I am about the pigmentation of this person. Can you pick out somebody that, that we would know?
You're asking me to pick somebody that
yes,
I think that my skin complexion mirrors. Oh, you know, I don't know. Because I've got, let me see. From, I, you know what, I would just tell them to go to my, look at my videos and they can see what my complexion is.
Okay. Would you say you're a lighter complexion?
I am a lighter skinned African American woman. And I will tell you that I get black from both just being African-American and being light-skinned. Now, I think it's more from the light-skinned aspect, honestly, because I have seen other African-American women here, whether visiting or living, who are brown-skinned or, you know, just more brown than me, or and they don't get the same treatment, pretty much. Or they are more welcomed or more the initial response is not as negative as it is with me. Like, I think when people see me, they don't know, you know, where I'm from or, you know, how I'm going to respond or act, and they, you know, tend to generalize you based on that alone about, you know, your complexion. And I think it also depends on the person in themselves. You know, if they've been exposed to a lot of different people, if they're well-traveled, well-educated, and knowledgeable about African-Americans, about different cultures, it is a different perspective. It doesn't happen with everybody, of course, but depending on the areas that I go into and the people that I talk to, I'm received differently. And then when my accent, you know, naturally, I don't sound like I'm from here. I have a strong American accent, and they pick that up and tend to put a lot of, you in that general box. And here they call Americans or white people Mzungu. And not saying that they're calling you a white person per se, but that they're categorizing you as that status, as if to say, okay, she's not from here, so she must have money, or she must have this, or she must have that. And that's, you know, it's so far from the truth. And I've had to fight so many battles in trying to not necessarily prove to people like, hey, you know, I'm not like that, but, you know, just to say, hey, give me a chance. You know, this is me. This is who I am. Get to know me. And a lot of times I've had to be the bigger person and speak up and, hey, how are you doing? You know, initiate a conversation and try to build those relationships, especially with women. It hasn't been so much with men, of course, but women are usually, it's very hard to try to break that barrier. And I know it has a lot to do with colorism. I think that colorism has divided our race across the globe, whether you're in the U.S. or in, you know, Uganda. I'm currently reading a book right now about colorism and how colorism has just affected us as a people, and how it's meant as that conquer and divide type tactic to keep us, you know, to keep us hating each other. And it's unfortunate, you know, we all come from the same. And, you know, why are we having to be separate and classify ourselves as one thing or the next? Or some people using that their color as more of an advantage or disadvantage, or feeling that they're not adequate or that they're, you know, superior, inferior. And that's the white people have done that and infiltrated that stigma on us, is what I think. But anyway, that's trickled over somehow here, and I just feel that people automatically assume that I'm unapproachable, or what we would say, conceited, or or some other negative stigma because of my complexion. Sometimes I feel like maybe they don't think that I am. Because they don't think that I'm Ugandan. I have gotten it sometimes. I will get it every now and then. People will think that I'm Ugandan, of course, before I open my mouth. For most of my experiences, you know, haven't been that. And it's the women that I have had issues with, you know, breaking that barrier.
Fascinating.
And building that bond.
What book are you reading on colorism right now?
You know, I would have to go get the book and tell you the exact title.
It's really good.
No, I can email you and you can tell your listeners. It's a really good book, though. It just kind of breaks down just different colorism issues, everything from the complexes of hair, the complexes of family dynamics. You know, you may have a lighter skinned sister, a darker skinned sister, and they hating, and you know, just having that separation. To everything about getting a job, to, you know, just anything that people will feel that your color signifies that you are either superior or inferior, you know. And I think people say if black people, well, I don't want to say for some reason, actually we know what the reason is with white supremacy, but of course us naturally as black people, we've always been deemed lower on every status level. So, you know, here though, like for example, in the States, I don't know what, you know, white people tend to, well, I don't know, you know, I'm not going to say that. I'm not going to.
Okay.
I'm rambling. I'm just gonna stop.
I will go to my next question then. In the same vein with how racism has impacted black people in Uganda, in terms of them perceptions of you because you're lighter complexion or because you're from the States, particularly you were saying, you know, maybe difficulties in forming relationships with other Ugandan females. You also talked about how you saw and you emphasized that this was not all Ugandans, but a portion. Some Ugandans are fearful of white people. How were you seeing this manifested?
Really on my job, honestly. I see it mainly on my job, but I have seen it out in other settings. But the video that I was speaking of was referencing a coworker of mine. We have a white, British white male director of the school, and you know he's a, you know, very straightforward guy. You know, it comes off as very approachable, but for her, I think she was frightened by him. She told me one day, she said, "I'm scared of him. I don't want to talk to him." You know, I said, "Well, why are you scared?" She said, "I just don't know." But you know, but she just kept saying she was scared. But I think that somehow. I've seen this in a lot of Ugandans that they have, you know, been programmed to be scared and fearful of these, you know, whites in these higher level positions. I don't know if it's fear of losing their job if they speak up, you know, fear of, you know, being judged, and that they have to put themselves lower to kind of feel. You know, just I feel that they're putting themselves in a lower category around these white people, like as if they don't have that. This lady, she didn't have the confidence to approach him. She didn't want to be, you know, seen just sitting at her desk. She said, "I have to always keep busy when he comes around. He may say something. He may do this. He may do that." So it's just this initial feeling of them being a threat in some sort. And that to me is like that colonized mentality because, you know, they somehow feel that, you know, that the white man is going to, you know, it's that power. It's just going back to the power thing. you know, somehow they feel just they just have that inferiority complex. In public, I've seen it differently out of the workplace, where they will be over accommodating to white people. Basically, I've been in situations where I've been in the front of the line and a white person who just have their white privilege hat on and just come up to the front and just expect to be waiting on because of them being white. And they will stop working with me to accommodate this white person. I've cussed so many people out because of it. Because, you know, and I tell them straight to their face. I say, you know, you stopped to work with me because this was a white woman. You know, it's wrong. You know, you can't just, you know, put me on hold. I'm a customer. My money works the same way. But it's happened to me several times, you know, and they have feel threatened in some way. And it just comes out in different, just from the actions that I see. Hello.
Oh, I thought I had unmuted. My question was, had you not seen black people be fearful of whites in the States, whether they stated it explicitly or whether it was just, you know, implied in their behavior around white people?
Of course. Yeah, I've seen it there. Oh. I've seen it. But not as much, though. I think I think us as black Americans are more outspoken and more willing to speak up about things and social injustices and racism. And, you know, if somebody treats you indifferent, we tend to speak up more about those things. But here I see it to be the opposite. I see it just being that, you know, it's like an okay, yes, ma'am, yes, sir type attitude. When you know this is wrong, so why are you not speaking up about it? Why are you allowing them to control? You know, and if you come here, you'll see that, you know, white people have Ugandan drivers, they have Ugandan nannies, they have Ugandan gardeners. Everybody is working for them as the house help. But really, it's like, you know, slavery all over again, and they can come here and do it, and they sucking it up. There's no way. And I see, like I said, a lot of these white Americans coming here and getting away with these types of attitudes. But I think for whatever reason, they put them in this category that they have this money and this status and this power. And then they tend to resort to being having that inferiority complex over that, you know. But in the States, I've seen it, but not as bad. I think we just tend to speak out a little bit more about it. Hmm. We tend to take more action against what, you know, we take way more action against that.
Hmm. That's fascinating. We've heard that repeatedly from many of our international listeners. Going back to what I said earlier about, you know, and for me, my definition of racism, white supremacy, is about one group dominating one group, specifically individuals who classify themselves as white, dedicating their time and energy to dominating, overpowering the people that they say are non-white, particularly black people, dominating and abusing those people collectively in all areas of people activity. What I think is so important about that term, power, when another group of people has power over you and is hostile to you, that is frightening. Like, it's logical to be afraid if you are in that sort of situation. And so, just going back, that's what I mean about power. I don't bump into white people who are, like, afraid that black people are going to, you know, stop them from getting a loan at the bank or are not going to hire them for a job, even in Uganda. Or, you know, are going to do something and just ruin their whole... I generally don't see white people who have that sort of fear of black people. Sometimes it's kind of irrational, their fears that they have of black people, if they say they're afraid at all. Black people have logical reasons anywhere in the world to be fearful of whites because of the power that they will. That's what I mean when we say racism. It really has to be connected to that element of power, because if it's just about me being upset, particularly if I'm upset about you mistreating me, that's not racist. Just logically, that's not racism. Racism is these, you know, whites from wherever they were born at coming to Uganda and, you know, getting a nanny and having these, you know, palaces for schools where they can pay $25,000 and have a great academic experience for their child while, you know, Ugandan children struggle to get toilets. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense. And that's why when earlier I was telling you about this bubble, because, you know, they're here, like I said, on a contract or whatever. They live in these big gated community houses. They put their children $25,000 a year, you know, tuition-based schools. But they have no community relations with locals. They have no impact, or they're not giving or contributing or helping to uplift the community. When they are starting, you know, businesses, the money is not going to support the local school systems or the women that are on the streets, you know, hustling to make money for their children, or the other several NGOs that are out here trying to better the community. That money goes to support their white families wherever they're from, or to help to empower them so they can be on a higher pedestal here. And a coworker was telling me white people, they like coming to Africa. They like coming to the continent because they can get away with that kind of stuff. They can live very good. They can have this nice income, live very cheaply, and have house help, and, you know, have that slavery mentality, and have, you know, people of color, like, you know, bowing down to them literally, and as opposed to being in the UK or in the States, when that's not tolerable. You know, so.
Yeah. Fascinating context of white supremacy, Miss Black Expat. Yeah, just try to keep that in mind when we think about that term, racism, and particularly white power. White power. I also think it's important when you talk about these whites in Uganda being in a bubble. Just in my view, I think it's most accurate and most likely that they are there to practice white supremacy, racism, that they like things the way that they are. And as you said, it seems like they're coming to enjoy white supremacy in that area of the world where they can live well, they can see black people suffering, and as I said, their children struggling to get toilets. They like that. They're not coming to fix any of those problems. They're coming to revel in it. It seems like that's a major racist activity all over the continent, really anywhere where there are black people suffering, to go and, you know, gawk and take selfies around black people in misery, and to keep them in misery for the next, you know, infinity. This just goes on and on and on and on. You also had a post. This is just connecting down from the colorism thing, and then when you talked about why are you scared of white people, some of the Ugandans being afraid of white people, where you said in that same post that not all Ugandans feel this way, that there are a lot of proud Ugandans who are all about Pan-Africanism and let's, you know, help black people worldwide, and, you know, they're not on that wavelength at all. You also said that there are, that you know, some open-minded whites, put that in quotes, who want to help. Who are these folks? What are they doing? Do you suspect them of racism? If not, why?
Okay, so I'll address the first half. yes, now, there's several very powerful, influential, highly educated, very resourceful Ugandans, and I've had the opportunity to meet quite a few. And what I, you know, appreciate about those relationships is, you know, that I've learned, you know, about the resilience overall, that, you know, that know not that they are the ones, like, you know, that are advocating against whites being a part of any of helping to, you know, uplift, because they're there for their own benefit and not to help, you know, with the overall community. So they're very aware and conscious of that. And I like that I've seen a lot of Ugandans, they may go to the States or other areas for their education and come back and bring resources, bring businesses, you know, build up corporations based on, you know, what they were able to obtain, you know, wherever they were. And it is helping to bring up and uplift uplift the community. So, yes, that's there. That is definitely here. It's not an impoverished community. I hope I didn't make it seem that way. I think with any environment, whether you're in Chicago, L.A., or wherever, you're going to have disenfranchised neighborhoods. You're going to have low-income neighborhoods. You're going to have very high, wealthy, influential, neighborhoods and surroundings and communities. So I just think it's just a good balance, and I've had the opportunity to be exposed to both sides of that spectrum. Now, with the white people that I was referencing, I see a lot of young white people come for volunteer programs. They come and do the just different volunteer programs. Like I just met a young white girl the other day who is getting ready to marry a Ugandan. And she came about she said she'd been here off and on for 5 years, but she initially came to do some volunteer work, and that she wanted to, I know that it had something to do with, I believe it was like a school, something with school improvement. But that she, finished the contract, ended up coming back, and, ended up meeting this guy, and now she's staying permanently. I hear a lot of those stories, from different white people, mainly white women that are coming to, volunteer, get involved in some NGO, and end up staying and, marrying a local. And, so that's who I was saying. I don't think that they have I'm not saying that they don't, but I think that the younger ones tend to have a more open-minded perspective on not necessarily the attitude of, we here, just to help the world type thing, but, we want to get out of our element. Let's come here. I think it's always going to be a hint of that white supremacy in a sense, because they feel like they have to help. That stigma of helping somebody, and that they have to come to East Africa and to Uganda in the most impoverished neighborhood to do that. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, okay, you here, you did your job. So from that aspect, you can see a tinge of the white supremacy attitude of that somehow they think that they have a better opportunity and they're trying to implement that within these programs. But when they come to stay for long extensive periods and they tend to get in the relationships and have children with locals, that always seems to really, throw me off a little bit. So then I question, okay, so maybe they are really, what's that about? But that's a completely different subject that, that I also have my own opinion about as well.
Do you see a connection between some of these individuals who classify themselves as white, who come to the continent, Uganda specifically, and they end up staying a long time, getting sexually involved with locals, even marrying or producing children with local Ugandans? Do you see a connection between what kind of throws you off a little bit, if I'm stating it correctly, about seeing that? Do you see a connection between that and kind of what you've written about with white families adopting African children?
Oh, you really have done your research, haven't you?
I try.
Oh, wow. You have really dug deep. So, okay. I was talking to a good friend of mine. This is a few months back, and there's a lot of interracial dating here. You see a lot of that. And I started to question it, like, why are these white girls coming here, dating these Ugandan guys? They end up getting married and everything. Not knocking the Ugandan guys at all, but I'm just saying, what is it? They're just purposely coming here. I know they're getting pregnant and they're having these babies. And he basically was telling me, can't you see the pattern? They're coming here, trying to break up, he was basically saying to break up the color and the race, and, trying to water down that, to intermix the children, that not to have a to keep it in line with being, that child to have a fully African, lineage. And so I had to think about that, is it really that deep where they're really making an effort to get impregnated by a Ugandan man? Or is it that they have a fascination with black men? There's a lot of white girls that have fascinations with black men. But it's happening so often. But the adoption piece that I brought up, now that's a whole nother subject, because it's like, there's these white American or white British families are coming here and they're adopting Ugandan children and uprooting them out of their Ugandan culture and taking them to the U.S. or wherever and raising them in their white supremacy-based household environments. And my fear is that these Ugandan children will grow up with a complex or not knowing who they are, knowing, you know, exactly, you know, what they're basically who they are, and, you know, not having having identity complex and not being able to connect back with their families and things like that. So that was my whole purpose of putting that video. I don't know if that was a video or a blog. I think it was a blog. But the dating thing, I keep telling myself I want to do an interview, and hopefully not to offend anybody, but just really interview and get down deep down and just interview some of these, the white women that I've seen, that I know personally. I've asked Ugandan men that are dating white women, and they just say, some people are telling me it's for the money. I think, again, some Ugandans are still fascinated with the ideal of having a white woman as like a trophy piece, which, you know, ideally in the States, you still see black men dating white women as like, hey, I've, you know, made this accomplishment, because they don't, you know, unfortunately do not respect and appreciate the black woman. That's how I look at it. But, you know, then some people say, oh, they're just in love, you know, and I'm just, you know, I find that a little difficult to understand about the love piece, because you're coming from two totally different backgrounds. You know, these are, you know, white women from the States coming here to Uganda. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, the Ugandan men that they choose are not of worthy status, but it's like, you really had to come to Uganda to find your husband. You know, I don't know. I'm baffled by it. So instead of me making all these assumptions, I really did want to just break down and interview a few of these interracial couples, just to get a deeper understanding of what this really means to them. And, you know,
you should do it. We would love to read it. I know many of our listeners, this is like way outside of our normal broadcast time. I know we lost it's no apology. You didn't do anything wrong. It's just, it's such a massive time difference between Uganda and here. But I'm sure folks will listen in the archives. They would love it. I'm sure some people would, you know, go out of their way so they could hear the live and not archive. If you could get any of these white women that are in these arrangements with black Ugandan males or have adopted children, it would be great. We would love to read, if you blog about it, or if you do a video about it, or if you want to do that and then get them to come hang out on our program, it would be great. We would love the chance to ask questions. I wanted to read a paragraph from that, because this was a blog post where you wrote about the adoption. And it's interesting, because the question that I asked was, do you see a relationship between, because you have a pretty explicit opinion about all of the ways that white supremacy can be manifest when whites decide to adopt, I say abduct, these black children anywhere in the world, that sound very similar to my views about everything that's incorrect about white people being sexually involved with a black person. I think it's the exact same power dynamic. And the paragraph I wanted to read, and I even want to ask to see if there's a word missing. So you write, that is the same for the Africans who decide to intermix. It is your responsibility to make sure your children know who they are, even if you're not too proud of it. Is it not supposed to be in there, or is it supposed to just read, it's your responsibility to make sure that your children know who they are, even if you're too proud of it? Is that the way it's supposed to read, or is there supposed to be?
Oh, it must be a typo.
Okay.
I think I'd have to go back to that post. What I was probably speaking of is, you know, even on both sides of the family, you know, whether it's a white, you know, white and black mix, that both sides, I believe, if that's what you decide to do, is to intermix and have children, that you on both ends have a responsibility to educate your children on both sides, whether you're black or white, you know, Hispanic. You still have that. And I'm speaking that out of the context of Uganda, and it's just in a whole, because I've seen a lot of one-sided families that are intermixed, you know, that the children identify as being white, or they don't have any identity of being black, or they don't know that experience, or the parents have not included them in that experience, or haven't made them, you know, feel that that's an important part of who they are. It's just, it would be that white focus, you know? So that's kind of what I meant, you know, as a black parent, if that is your responsibility, if you decide to marry a white person, that's your business. But I believe you still have a responsibility to educate your children on who they are on that side.
Right. You, within that same paragraph, you continue, you said, a good friend recently posed a question to me: are Africans and whites integrating to purposely attempt to diminish the effects of the African race? Is it intentional that lighter-skinned children with less defined textured hair are more accepted in a society? You do say no to the question that he posed. I would submit that, you know, that is something that should be thought about, as well as the same thing with the adoption piece. I think it's the exact same thing in terms of whites having all this control over the future of the continent, the future of black people. We had people that did dial in with a question. Folks, if you have anything you would like to ask Miss Black Expat, feel free to chime in. The number 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. If we have people that are listening while at work, you can email your question and I will read it on the air. The caller at 0325-0325, did you have a question for Miss Black Expat?
Oh, yes, I have a question.
Yes, sir.
And thank you guys. I really appreciate it. Like this time, the 1 p.m. time. Good for me anyway, but I wanted to ask a question about there's an article online with the Inquiries Journal, and it's entitled Sexual Relations Between Elite White Women and Enslaved Men in the Antebellum South, a Socio-Historical Analysis by J.M. Elaine. And I wanted to ask Ms. Expat, I wanted to ask her if she's aware of, or if she has thought about the power differential between the white women that come over to supposedly help the Ugandans, the power difference between them and the Ugandan males, and if that power difference, if she thinks, or she believes, or she has thought about the power difference being like the same as, you know, during slave time, when the slave master, or the slave master, and the slave master's wife having power over the black male slave, and the black male slave, having to acquiesce to whatever desire, the slave master's wife had, and that dynamic being there.
You know, it's very, very possible. A lot of, I believe, a lot of that relationship, a lot of that power is usually, I've seen this, where the Ugandan men are actually taking advantage of the white woman because of her status, her financial status, you know, even as deep as getting passport and visa and all those types of opportunities. So in terms of the white woman imposing her power, I can't say that it's not happening, but I'm not directly interfacing with those relationships, so I don't have that firsthand. I'm just seeing from the outside. But it can be power struggle in multiple ways, you know, in terms of getting access to certain things because, you know, their husband or their boyfriend is Ugandan, or, you know, having better opportunities while they're here because they have that Ugandan relationship. But from the stories that I've heard, I'm seeing it on the flip side, that Ugandan men are being very smart in their approach when they get together with these white women, that, yes, they may pose it as love, but a lot of times it's for that white that advantage that, you know, that they feel that they can get from that white woman.
Okay. Can I ask one more question? Or
sure.
Okay. Are you also, or have you ever? I know you talked about the. I saw the video where you talked about the Ugandan man, the white man who was practicing racism against a child, his non-white child. Have you ever come in contact, or have you ever heard of white women, maybe in the United States or even in Uganda, white women practicing racism against their non-white children once they have a child with a Ugandan male, or even in the United States, have you ever heard of a white woman having a child with a black male or non-white male, and that child is racism is practiced against them via, like we've heard on the cows, via, you know, not wanting to do the child's hair, joking the child's hair, not teaching the child about properly about black history or African history, things of that nature.
Yeah, I've seen that too. I've seen, you know, they are trying to, you know, keep that child as far away from, you know, that their Ugandan or their black side as much as possible. Maybe by what they expose them to, the types of friends that they allow them to hang around, you know, the way they wear their hair, anything, you know, that can try to keep them, you know, not really confident or sure about their ethnicity, their race, their black ethnicity. So yeah, I've seen it on both ends of the spectrum in the States and in Uganda as well. I can't think of like a specific, but I know that it has happened. It's happening, you know. And I think that here they can probably get away with it a little bit more than they would in the States. I hope I answered your question. Sorry if I didn't.
You did. I did have one more, if Gus will let you ask one more.
Okay.
All right. I wanted to ask you, are you aware of the, I guess I would say circuit, the circuit that many white women go on internationally? I think it's many older white women go on this circuit. It's like they go to the islands and things of that nature. They go to some African countries just to sleep with black males or African males or non-white males. They sleep with these men. Sometimes it may be having to do with some type of a spiritual thing. They like the guys with the dreadlocks because they feel like they get some type of energy from these guys. But, you know, that older white women are, you know, the ones that are retired and have money, they're going on these circuits as well. And if that's true, if you haven't heard of that, if that be true, and you see younger white women doing it also via, you know, the core or whatever NGOs, they're doing the same thing, what would you have to say about that? If the older white women were doing the same thing as many of these younger white women going around to different international countries to hook up and have credit arrangements with, you know, black males?
You know, honestly, I really think that white women just love black men, you know, whether they're old or young. I just think they have a fascination with black men, regardless of what they may tell you. I think another thing that I've seen, and I've seen this in the States, and I don't know, you know, how really valid this is, but a lot of white women use their white status to obtain a black man to basically throw it in our faces, black women, that, hey, I got your man. And I see that a lot here, too. And a lot of Ugandan women, you know, they don't like the fact to see a white woman with their men, you know. I personally frown upon it as well, because I just find that, you know, I just find that there's ulterior motives on both ends of that spectrum, that, yes, there could be a true love connection, but in actuality, what are you really here for? But I just think, to answer your question, I just think that the white women just generally have a fascination with black men, and it's just kind of just a fantasy to sleep with a black man, you know, coming here to the continent, you know, like I said, Ugandan men or whoever. And I can only speak for Ugandan. I really can't speak for other African nationalities in terms of how the men operate. But I think that they feed into it just as much, because, you know, here's this older white woman who's got money, who can help support them and their lifestyle, you know, whether that's traveling or whatever. I actually met a white woman in the UAE before I left the UAE, actually, who lived in Uganda for 7 years before moving to the UAE, and she married a Ugandan man, and he was 20 years younger than her, had a mixed race child and everything, And I'm not saying, you know, she just wasn't the most attractive white woman and he was like 20 years younger, so I just didn't understand what that was all about. But I just think that both each other, they are there to use, to take advantage in some aspect, you know, of each other, you know? I hope I, you know, answered that.
Appreciate it.
Correct?
Thank you.
Appreciate that, caller. Yeah. I want our listeners, this is for listeners, if you participated in the book study session on Edward Baptist, The Half Has Never Been Told, where he has the passage in his book. This is a book about enslavement of black people in the U.S. He has a passage in the book where he says that enslaved black females who were going to be raped by white slave owners, that they could leverage the situation. That was the term I think he used specifically. They could leverage the situation if they knew that the enslavers, the white enslavers, wanted to sexually take advantage of them. They could try to use that to get better treatment. Does that sound similar to what we're hearing about black males in Uganda and whatever they might be trying to get from white females? This is for listeners who heard that. Does this sound similar? The question we had from a different listener, she wanted to ask, who do you think is most confused about what racism is and how it works? Do you think white people are most confused, or do you think non-white people are most confused about what racism is and how it works?
Well, and that's what you're asking me, that question, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so I think that sometimes we as black people can be confused about the question of racism because, you know, what I was telling you earlier, you know, it can be a frustration or something, you know, that we, you know, when you're asking me the question of are black people racist? And, you know, my response was, you know, I've seen, we have reacted very, you know, frustrated or angry or try to retaliate and all those things, but it's still the issue of power. So I think white people very much know that they have that power. They're very well, you know, knowledgeable of, you know, what that means to them and the advantages that they have, the white, you know, privilege advantages. And that sometimes we can, you know, think that, yes, we're being racist to this particular individual, but unless that can be implied as having a higher level of power over that group or individual, then really it's not racism, you know, because that implies that there's power. So I think that's, you know, how I would respond to that.
Fascinating. We'll see if our caller in Michigan, if that satisfactory answer to her question. I also did want to say, because you did use the term love earlier to describe, you said fascination, but you also said white women love black males. And just that word, I know people have a lot of different meanings for what they mean with the term love. I would submit if white women really loved black males, racism wouldn't exist. White women could get busy and knock this problem out like today. Retired firefighter in Florida, did you have a question for Miss Black X Pat? You should be with us.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, everyone, and greetings to the guests. First of all, I'd like to applaud you and your willingness to go abroad. That takes a lot of, I guess the best word that I can use right now, probably the better word is courage to do that. But my question is, I saw the clip that Gus put on his Facebook of you speaking about the incident with the quote unquote Russian white person, white male, with the non-white child. You stated a couple of times that you used the word, I think, on your behalf, that you were confused, and on his behalf, it's him being ignorant. My question is, have you considered that that white person is not ignorant, but it's actually you witness a white person practicing racism and white supremacy?
Just for our listeners, I didn't mean to interrupt, but the video that he's referencing, since we haven't talked about it, can you kind of just give the context before you answer his question about this Russian parent and one of the students in your class so everybody knows what we're talking about?
Yeah, sure. And thank you also for the call, to the caller for commending me on my courage for going abroad. I really appreciate that. But the video that is being referenced, I had an incident with this was last school year, a parent who is Russian, and he had a child with a Ugandan woman. So he still, you know, he would come to my classroom regularly and just express, you know, he was very open and, you know, vulgar with the things that he would say. And, you know, this one particular time, I had planned a field trip, and one of the field trip was actually going to that local school that I was telling you about, Gus, where they are dealing with some shortages on toilets and, you know, some other school improvement issues. So I wanted to, because it's our community linked school, expose our children in the international school community to a local school setting so that they can kind of get a different experience. So, you know, the parents still had to fill out a permission slip and everything, but this particular parent, he was the only one that hadn't filled one out. So I sent him an email and I said, can you please let me know yay or nay if you're going? So he came to visit me and, you know, just was very frank with me, just, you know, asking me, you know, if this was a local, you know, Ugandan school. And I told him, yes. He says, I don't want my child around those people. I hate Ugandans. They're ignorant. You know, he just kept going on and on and just diminishing Ugandans, just tearing them down. Mind you, my teacher's assistant was sitting right in the room with us, and she's Ugandan. Mind you, his daughter is partly Ugandan, and mind you that he's in Uganda, but he's negatively speaking about Ugandans, you know, in such a hateful way, and basically telling me that he does not want his daughter in that environment, to see that she doesn't like Africa. She wants to go to Europe and Russia. And I just asked him, I said, can you really stop for a minute and think about the things that you're saying? I just cut him completely off. I told him I don't want to continue this conversation because I don't respect that. I don't appreciate, you know, you bringing that negative energy into my classroom, nor do I appreciate you diminishing the country or the people that live in the country that I currently reside in, because I don't have those same beliefs. And just, you know, finally, you know, he obliged and let his daughter, you know, go. But it was just an upward battle. I didn't understand his hatred, the level of hatred that he was so open about. You know, most white people, they have that indirect white supremacy racist attitude, but he was very open about it. And I was able to have a pretty good dialogue with him on several different occasions about it. But this one particular incident really, really rubbed me the wrong way. And I just had to make a video about it, expressing my frustrations and, you know, just my thoughts around, you know, why he would be so vulgar and why is he in Uganda. And, you know, I had all these whys as to, you know, and he couldn't really answer that for me. He kept telling me, you know, his job contract was ending and, you know, he was only here because he had a business opportunity, which was pretty much white supremacy. He was able to obtain a business fairly easily. He was, you know, having Ugandans work for him. He was leveraging income opportunities that were going back to support his wealth in Russia, but it wasn't implementing anything in the Ugandan communities. So that's partly what I was speaking about earlier about, you know, about them coming, you know, here just to take advantage of the resources and the opportunities. But that's the basis of the video, you know, as to, you know, what that was pretty much about and my, you know, my frustrations.
Did you want to repeat your question, retired firefighter, so she can answer it now that we all are?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. My question was, have you considered, other than the white person being ignorant, have you considered that maybe that white person, you actually witnessed a white person practicing racism, white supremacy?
I've witnessed it. Yes, I've witnessed it. I see it all the time. I see how, you know, the white parents come to my school. They overlook, you know, the Ugandan teachers. I've even had a teacher question my credentials. I've had teachers. This hasn't happened to me directly, but I've had another teacher tell me that the parent took her child out of her classroom because she said she doesn't want a black teacher. I've seen it all. I've seen it, you know, still that dominant white supremacist attitude, you know, even, you know, wherever they are, they just have the feel that they are, you know, at a better advantage and that everybody else is beneath, you know, beneath who they are. You know, just like I said, I've been questioned numerous times. I had one guy, he couldn't speak to me directly, but I guess another lady was introducing me, and you know, she introduced me as this teacher, and he said, oh, she's a teacher, you know, so he was shocked that me as a black woman could actually be an educator, you know, so it was just, I've dealt with it all, so yes, I've seen it on several occasions here.
Did that answer your question, retired firefighter?
Yes, for the most part. She didn't direct it directly with the person. Mm-hmm. But that's good enough because she made a much more broader analysis, and I think it meant that she does consider that white person or white people are not ignorant, and they practice racism, and she observed that as such. Mm. Would that be correct, ma'am?
Yeah, I don't think that they're ignorant to it. I think that they're very knowledgeable what they're doing. So, no, I don't think it's like a, okay. You know, I don't know what I'm doing. You know, I'm clueless about what it is.
Good,
no, they're very, very knowledgeable with what they're doing. No, I'm sorry that I didn't answer your question in the first place, but no,
yes,
they
ma'am.
Know.
Good enough for me. Yes, ma'am.
No, thank you.
Appreciate that, retired firefighter. The caller at 4130, 4130. Did you have a question for Miss Black Expat?
Yes, she...
Hello, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, thank you, Gus, and thank you to the guest. I just wanted to ask a little more. I know you mentioned in the incident with your son that it was an Egyptian teacher. And my question was, would you say that Egyptians classify themselves as non-white? Do you think that they see themselves as African? Or would you say that the majority of them that you've encountered consider themselves as white?
You know, that's a good question. Thank you. Thank you for that question. In that in particular environment in the UAE, most of them, to me, they classified or identified themselves as white. I didn't find many of them that would say, you know, proudly African or consider themselves from the continent. Most Egyptians or people from other parts of the world still classify Egypt. They don't even want to even acknowledge that it's on the continent. So, yes, in that context, he was operating as a white man to, you know, obviously feel that he can have that level of authority over my son and feel that it was appropriate to put his hands on him. I still think that they realize that they are not, you know, white, but they do feel that they're better than black people. Like, you know, from Sub-Saharan Africans, you know, or black Americans, you know, I just feel that they still think that they are on a higher level of class, you know. So yes, I think they don't class. I don't consider it. Now there are some I have met. I'm not saying that all. I think that everybody, you know, has a right to, you know, have an individual reference to, you know, they don't have to all. Everybody's classified under that. I have seen Egyptians that, you know, I visited Egypt a few years ago, and I've encountered very proud Egyptians who were very open about expressing that they, you know, were African. They were, you know, that they still identify themselves as such. But the ones in the UAE tend to not as much identify with their African, being identified as an African.
Female caller, did that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
For sure.
Thank you.
We are flexing super international today since we're on so early. Some of our UK listeners could chime in and participate. Mr. Fox, did you have a question for Miss Black Expat?
Greetings, Gus, callers, and the guests. Some of my questions have been answered, but I have a couple still. In the video regarding the Ugandan child with the Russian parent, you stated that the father suffered from self-hate. What did you mean by that?
I think more because he, I don't know, what, did I say that he had self-hate or he was hating toward his daughter?
It was around the 3:40, 3:45 where you said that he suffered from self-hate and he didn't know himself.
Okay, probably because every encounter that I really had with this man was very negative. And everything that he said was a downgrade about other people, you know, other nationalities, the way things were being, you know, functioning around the school. Everything was just negative. And I just find that people who have a very pessimistic outlook on life in general tend to be unhappy in some way, or, you know, maybe there's something that they're insecure about or they don't, you know, love about themselves. So I think I was probably going along that route when I said he had an issue with, with self, you know, he didn't love himself because it was, you know, just constant. Everything was just, had a negative energy about him, you know, so.
Okay, so you just said that he had a negative image of himself and he had no love for himself, so that's why he classed it as self-hate, or he didn't know himself.
Just the fact, I feel that if somebody is constantly complaining, constantly having to bring other people down and degrade other people, is because it's something that you are insecure with within yourself. So if you feel that you have to bring other people down for you to be lifted up, then you have an issue, whether it's, you know, self-hate, insecurity, whatever. But all of those things have to do involve with, you know, you're not fully, you know, loving yourself. You know, so I just sensed that from him, that he was dealing with some personal battles within himself, for him to, you know, have a negative reflection on everything, even from his daughter. You know, he would bring her to school. He wouldn't comb her hair. He would have her looking any type of way. He didn't want her to know about her Ugandan mom. He would downgrade the Ugandan mom in front of his daughter. You know, all these things. It's like I just felt that, you know, there was something deep in him that either was regretful or hateful about who he was. Because any time, like I said before, if somebody has to bring you down, it's something about them that they don't like, because that makes them feel better when they bring someone else down. I know it sounds very elementary, but I really just sense that about this guy.
So when this encounter happened, the encounter in the video, was the daughter present as well?
No, actually, during most of our conversations, she wouldn't even be in the room. He would come to me after school and just kind of, you know, walk in my classroom with this very, you know, interrogating mode, you know, asking me these questions and just kind of putting me, you know, putting us in these situations where we're talking about race relations, or, you know, and I would challenge him about it. It got to a certain level where, you know, I would just start challenging him about things because we had that type of dialogue. But no, his daughter was never around. She he would always come when she wasn't in the area.
Is the mother still on the scene?
I'm sorry?
Is the mother still on the scene? Is she still around? Is she still a part of the child's life?
You know, from what I was hearing from the child, they would see each other on the weekends. You know, he would allow that, but, you know, he just kept the dad always spoke negatively about allowing the daughter to have a cohesive relationship, because last year we had gotten into a bit of a debate on whether or not he should move her to Russia. And I said, that is completely detrimental to this child. She looks like a black child, an African child. She's not going to be accepted and acknowledged and treated with respect in a Russian, you know, white society. I said, you can't do that. I said, leave her with the mom. And he completely disagreed with me and told me that the mom was inadequate and, you know, unable to take care of the child, which, you know, in some aspects, maybe that was the case from maybe a financial perspective. But I believe the child would have been in a better, more adaptive environment by staying in Uganda. Now, that child, they're still at the school. They're still in Uganda. Of course, she's no longer my student, you know, this year. But I do see them from time to time. She looks happy. I haven't asked her about, you know, her relationship with her mom at this point. But, you know, like I said, the last time we spoke, they did see each other typically on the weekends, probably just for a few hours, just to have that dialogue. And I actually encouraged that. I don't think it was happening initially, but when I asked about the mom and the relationship with mom, I encouraged him to start building that relationship, and that she needs to have an understanding of her Ugandan side, and having ties with family here, because when she gets old enough, she needs to be able to make a decision as to which way she wants to go. You know, does she want to, you know, identify with this Russian, you know, white race, or does she identify more with the Ugandan race? You know, most children that don't have both of those exposures at an early age, especially those multiracial children, tend to grow up very split on where they feel that they feel more comfortable.
How many languages can she speak? Can she speak Russian?
Yeah, she spoke Russian fluently. I think she understood some Luganda. Of course, she spoke English. But I believe she was born and had a couple of years in Russia before they moved to Uganda. I think they've been in Uganda for about 3 or 4 years now, because she's about 7 going on 8. Mm-hmm.
Can I ask some more questions, Gus, or is there other people on the line?
I reckon you can proceed.
Yeah. What is the age of the father? Would you say, 40s, 50s?
I would say, you know, it's very hard for me. I'm not trying to be judgmental, but it's very hard for me to guess, you know, white people's age, because they just age differently. But I would say he's probably in his early 50s. And I believe the mom is in her... I'm just assuming, because she might be in her 30s, late 20s, early 30s. I've heard different situations about this family from teachers that, you know, had this student prior, that the father was just looking for a good time, and he had a hookup, and just things happened, and that's how it turned out. But I don't believe that per se, because I believe if things just happened, he wouldn't have been full-fledged to take on that much responsibility. He has full, you know, coverage of this child, full custody, I'm sorry, of this child. So yeah, but I think he's older. I just feel like he has that. I think I also mentioned in my video that, you know, the white men in this category, the older white men, they feel that they may have a bit of a dominance over the Ugandan women. And I've seen quite a bit of Ugandan young women sleeping around with older white men, whether it's for money or whatever, but the white men are using them for sex and the women are getting money, you know, money out of it. So you still have the low-key prostitution going on. And that might have been that case. I don't know. But either way, he's, you know, very committed to this girl, but just with the wrong attitude. You know, I just don't like the fact of him implying his white supremacist attitude on this black identified black child. Because if you look at her, you wouldn't think that she had any type of Russian roots to her. You know, she would identify as a black child.
Because if he takes her to Russia, she's going to struggle in a bad way.
Exactly. And, you know, he was actually leaning toward taking her because he kept just expressing his frustrations about living in Uganda and how backwards it is. And there's, you know, no infrastructure, and just, you know, the Ugandans are very ignorant. Like, he just kept going on and on about his his hatred, you know, toward being here, and that he kept saying, I'm going to take her with me. And I felt so bad for that child. I said, there's just no way, because people there are 10 times worse than you probably. And, you know, this child is going to suffer horribly.
Because I do find the Eastern Europeans, the Slavic people, I just think they're the most unrefined white people you'll ever come across.
In terms of, you know, just being blatantly racist, or what are you?
I said it more as in a statement, but I have been to the Eastern Europe, and if they don't let you know how they feel about you via body language, they will just say it.
Oh, yes, actually, you know, my son's teacher is from Bulgaria, I believe, and I shared with her my story when I initially met her, and, you know, told her that she knew I was, you know, from the States, and that I'm a single mom and all those things, and she completely judged me and my son at the inside, and has, you know, just came off in that way of, you know, her body language and just, you know, how she communicates to me about him and his progress. And, you know, naturally from whatever she's researched about Black American boys, that they have low attention focus, or they you know, have ADHD or behavioral problems. She always prefaces our conversations with, you know, he's not really focused, or this and that. You know, so that's how it was initially. And then I had to completely shut her down. And now that she sees how my son's performance is, and, you know, that he is not whatever idea that you had put in your mind, you know, but they do tend to have that from what I've seen from her, that attitude that they don't like you, that they'll show it through their verbal or body language.
Yeah, that's correct. Zero filters. Yeah, that's all my questions. Thank you.
Right on.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you.
Appreciate that. With the with the situation with this white supremacist Russian male and this Ugandan Black female, where it seems like there's a considerable age difference as well, do you think, just using logic, your assessment, do you think it would be most accurate to describe this arrangement, tragic arrangement, if ever that term was appropriate? Do you think it would be most accurate to describe this as a situation that is mutually exploitative, where this white man is taking advantage of this young Black female who's, you know, certainly less powerful than he is and in need of resources, perhaps? He's taking advantage of her sexually. She's taking advantage of him, maybe seeing what she can get in terms of resources out of all this. They're both kind of exploiting each other in different ways. Or do you think it would be, logically speaking, most accurate to say that this is a situation where this racist white male is practicing racism and taking advantage of this Black female who's in a weak position and even sexually exploiting her? Which do you think would be most accurate to describe the situation logically?
I think logically the latter would be most accurate. I don't think it was like a love connection. I think it was just literally for him to get to have, you know, to dominate her through a sexual relation, to have that level of control over her, to feel needed and to feel that, you know, you need me to survive type attitude, and then I can control your livelihood, you know, because I hold your whole world in my hands. You need me to survive, that kind of attitude. I don't know if she logically realized what she was getting herself into, whether she thought it was, you know, this man was going to love me and, you know, we were going to have this life together, or is this, you know, is this man taking advantage? And it was obviously the latter. And now she's probably feeling obligated in some sense because they have a child together, or feeling dependent in some way, because he's probably provided for her one way or the next through other obligations. You know, if we continue this sexual relationship, then okay, yes, I will give you X, Y, and Z to help you, you know, buy food or whatever else that you need. But yeah, I think that's what happened. Honestly, I just I don't know anybody in their right mind that would want to be with this particular man. I mean, I don't know, but I know a lot of Ugandan women. I'm sorry. Let me take that back. I don't want to say a lot, but I've seen Ugandan young girls with these older white men. And I feel bad for them, I think, because they feel that there was something there. They felt, okay, maybe he loves me, or he wants me, or he, you know, he's going to marry me, or, you know, be there for me and give me this child, you know. And then it turns out to be that he just used you for sex, and that now that you're so dependent on him that you've lost who you were, and lost control of what you're capable of doing, because you're so dependent on this man, and you put him above everything because, you know, maybe because he's white, or, you know, you think his dollar is going to stretch longer. Well, I don't know, but I've seen it, yes. So I think logically, yes, that he just is using her.
Wow.
He just used her for sex. But the women, I don't know. You know, honestly, though, because I really don't know. Now, that's the situation. But I have seen other situations where there are Ugandan women. I do think that they realize that they are just having, this guy just wants to have a sexual relation, and they're getting the money out of it. So, I mean, I think it can go just honestly both ways. But this one isolated situation with my student, I do believe that she thought it was something more. And, you know, maybe even because she went as far as having, you know, getting pregnant with his child, and then later finding out that it was just this use and abuse type white supremacist relationship.
Hmm. Okay. At least for me, the fact that in this situation, this Russian white man or any of these other, if you want to kind of broaden the spectrum a little bit, these many white men and white women who come over and are doing this, engaging in sexual activity with these black people all over the continent, in my view, the fact that their grandpappies and grandmothers and aunts and uncles and great-grandfathers and great-grandmothers are responsible for these black people directly or indirectly being in the situation that they're in, where they might need these resources, that greatly weighs on my assessment of these arrangements, regardless of how much the black person knows or doesn't know about this whole situation and the power dynamics and white supremacy as a global system. The fact that whites are to blame for why things are the way they are on the continent, in my view, whites are most to blame for why that is. That weighs heavily on how I evaluate everything that happens, particularly as it relates to how white people and non-white people, black people particularly, are functioning together anywhere in the world. Hopefully that makes sense for listeners. I did want to echo the black firefighter's comment about courage, because I had that word specifically in my notes. The courage for a single black mother to go out by yourself. You know, didn't have an entourage with you or what have you to go out and do this and travel and teach and explore the world just, you know, because of your spirit and being curious. That's something we talk about on this program before, and how you inspire courage, how you cultivate courage, the importance of being a courageous black person. Just can you speak to that? Do you think that that's something that has showed some courage on your part to go out and do this and then to bring your son along after you got settled as well?
Absolutely. Everything, every aspect, I call it more of a step out on faith, because, you know, a lot of this has been just a completely blind walk. You know, I didn't know what I was really getting myself into, and just having the courage to just go take that step, to just do it for one. And then the courage to get through all the obstacles and the challenges, the cultural differences, just everything else that comes with the overall experience. So I would definitely say it is courage. It takes a lot to be able to do it. But at the same time, you know, we have to be real with ourselves. I'm coming to a point in my journey where I have, you know, had a really good taste of what this life is like. Living abroad, I've enjoyed every aspect of it. You know, whether it's negative or positive, it's taught me so much about myself and about life. I've become a completely out of my shell, out of my comfort zone. But I'm getting to a point where I feel that I need to take a step back and may need to rekindle some ties back home with family members. I just feel like, you know, I'm just feeling that that's kind of where I am in my journey right now. So sometimes we just have to be open and honest with ourselves. Yes, it takes a lot of courage, but, you know, sometimes we just need that. We need those relationships. We need that support. We need that help. We need that reconnection. We need the stability, you know, things that we may not be able to find on the journey overseas, because it comes with so many complexities that we are steady trying to find our way. And that all of that takes courage, you know, to even just say that I can, you know, try something new, go into a different country, not know a soul, and make it, you know. And I think that anybody listening that is interested in doing this, you know, go for it, but just really, really research what you're getting yourself into, and really acknowledge yourself, your inner self, on why you're doing it in the first place. You know, it's definitely not a journey for everybody. But I will say it is a life-changing journey, and if it's something that you decide to do, it's very worthwhile. And just, you know, just be ready for a lot of life-changing experiences.
With the politics specifically in Uganda, definitely appreciate that answer. And again, just to echo what retired firefighter said, because I think that is outstanding illustration of black self-respect and courage to go out and to do that, to travel alone in a big world dominated by white supremacy as a black mother. Outstanding. But just with local Uganda politics, and we don't want to take up your whole evening, but I know we in the States have been seeing where, not just in Uganda, on the entire continent, they've been talking about gay rights and LGBT issues. This has come up in Uganda specifically, and people in the U.S., in my view, racist suspects have kind of admonished black people on the continent and elsewhere about being homophobic, and you need to do more to push gay rights forward. And they were talking about a march that was called off in Uganda earlier this summer for threats that there might have been anti-LGBT violence or protesters. Have you followed that issue at all? Have you seen that in the time that you've been there?
No, I haven't seen at this particular, I think you were just saying, you know, whatever this was over the summer that, you know, I wasn't here to witness that. But I know that Uganda is a very, you know, they don't acknowledge the, you know, the gay community. It's not, you know, acknowledged and respected. So people they're not very open with that. You know, if that's the lifestyle that you decide to live, it's not respected here. I guess that's the best way for me to say it. But I don't really follow it. I'll be honest with you. I can't really give you much of my insight because I don't follow it. I mean, these are just things that I know about living here and just how the society is as a whole. They're very conservative in respects to general, you know, just lifestyle. So, you know, having, you know, lesbian or gay, you know, relationships is just frowned upon. It's looked at as just completely, you know, unacceptable.
Got it. It's this was in your area, Kampala, exactly. I had to go back to look to just get the details, but this was in August.
No. Yeah, well, it depends. I was in the States from the end of June to the end of August, so I probably missed it. Okay. And at the time I came back in August, my son was with me, and I was scrambling around getting ready for school and getting him settled and acclimated. So more than likely, a lot of things that happened in the actual city, I may have missed, or I may have not even been here. You know, I don't know what the date of this event was. What was the date?
August the 11th.
Oh, okay. You know what? I think I didn't get back until that week, that weekend. I left the States on the 10th, so I probably didn't get there till about the 12th. So it was around that. It takes with the flight over, you know, the flight delays, it takes me about 2 days, and then with the time difference. So I was just missing it. You know, I didn't know anything about it. No.
Wow. Okay. I'll send you the report. You can check it out.
Yeah, definitely.
The last question I wanted to get in, we have had some people who've articulated the view basically that African-Americans, black people born here in the States, have a totally different experience, that black people, African-Americans, have been here in North America for a long, long time, and a lot of that history has been erased. A lot of that history is before slavery, and we don't need to find anything on the continent, that Africans do not see themselves as being connected to black people in the States. We have separate problems. Racism is a problem for all of us, but we have separate problems, separate issues. We're not the same, and that we don't need to, you know, invest a whole lot of time in trying to hook up with these folks who, you know, are not interested in joining with us anyway, that we should just focus on our own issues here in North America and solve racism as best we can in this part of the world. What would your response to that be?
You know, that's a very complex question, Gus, and I'd have to answer that in different parts. Just to address the relationships among African Americans and Africans, I just think that it's still a part of that divide and conquer mentality that white people have implied. You know, naturally within the American school system, we are not educated about our African history nor anything past Martin Luther King. You know, everything is basically just kind of brushed off, that there was, that we didn't have any prior history. So then therefore, as children, unless our parents are very conscious and, you know, very, you know, willing to educate us past what the schools were telling us, we didn't know much about that. So therefore, there was that lack of connection. And then with what the media puts out there, the media is the biggest devil in this whole situation when you ask about relationships between African and African Americans, because as an African American, the what we see, unless we dig deep, on the forefront of, you see the white-owned media companies, they are always advertising Africa, the continent, or Africans as impoverished or a very low or developing situation, and that it's just, we've always thought of that as being a disconnect, that that's not a, who we are, that's not a part of us. And on the flip side, Africans feel that us as African Americans are, you know, ignorant, or, you know, we have no culture. I hear this all the time. No culture, we're ignorant, and don't understand who we are and where we come from. Now that's, you know, these are on extreme ends. I've heard, and me personally, I do think that yes, there is a disconnect. I think that's even why I have a hard time building relationships with the Ugandan women specifically, because, you know, of the mentality that has been developed about us as African-American women, specifically, you know, how we carry ourselves, you know, they're showing the worst images of us being half-dressed or, you know, sleeping around, or, you know, just having multiple kids by different men. This is just the worst thing that, you know, that they put out there about us, but never show us being educated or, you know, successful or owning our own businesses or, you know, having, you know, happy, healthy black families. It's always the negative aspect. So, you know, me saying all this to say that it's just, yes, that's there. I think that the underlying aspect is there. Now, I can't, there's a lot of African Americans that I personally know that still think that that Africans are living in some type of hut. I know it sounds very ignorant, but I've heard this from people. They make jokes to me like, you know, where are you living? How are you eating? You know, these types of things. And then I have, I know a lot of my conscious friends that are very, you know, very involved in African culture, politics, and relationships and building relationships, and have done research to try to get more, you know, insight into what our connection really means, you know, and trying to figure out where they stand in this whole dynamic. And on the flip side, you know, Africans who have completely open-armed welcomed African Americans as another brother or sister, and have totally included us in that African diaspora. I just had a really good conversation. I wrote a blog post about this. I was in Rwanda a week ago, and I really had a good conversation with a young lady, and she, you know, she wanted to know where I was from and everything, and I just knew that we were going to have this. She was going to give me the once over eye up and down, you know, when I told her I was from the States, you know, here we go, another black American chick, you know, And that was completely, you know, not the attitude that she gave me. And we just started talking, and she just basically said that we are all African, you know, we are African people. We're together. And I identify myself as such. Yes, I know we have different cultures. You know, my African brothers and sisters in Uganda had a completely different experience growing up here. And I had a completely different experience there, but we still have a connection. I believe strongly that there is still that connection, that I think that if more of us could acknowledge that, then we would have more peaceful relationships and more meaningful and productive relationships. But also respecting the fact that we do come from different places, and to respect each other's culture as well, and not to demean or diminish that culture. Because, yes, African Americans have a culture that may be a different aspect of an African living on the continent, growing up, born and raised. So as long as we can openly respect those views and, you know, and cultural differences, and then but still come together and integrate in a productive manner, then I think that we can really make something positive and about building back our communities across the globe.
Context of white supremacy. The address again, missblackexpat.com. If you go to the website, you'll see pictures. You will see confirmation, as I stated, the lovely Miss Black Expat, and then you'll also see the link for her YouTube channel, her blog post. It's got different subheadings where you can check out some of the different titles, subjects that she writes about, racial injustice being the top subtitle, and then traveling reviews, teaching rants, raising a black boy abroad, life on the continent. Great information. You can just kind of track where she is and what she's up to. Ask questions. She's very responsive. People, if you post questions on her YouTube page or to the different blog posts that we have, really enjoyed having you on the program. I was super serious. I encourage you as much as I can to go out and see if you can get some of these white women who are in these tragic arrangements with yes. Ugandan males or whites who have abducted Ugandan children. See if you can get an interview, put it on your channel. We will definitely watch and comment and share. And then if you can get them also, see if they would be willing to come hang out on our program, because we'd love to ask them some questions as well. But I just wish you, your son, your family the best. Keep up your outstanding work. And I'm really glad, particularly with the storm and everything, you were such a trooper and so patient with your time. Just thank you so much for hanging out with us. It was great to hear from you.
Yes, Gus, it was such an honor to be a part of your show this evening. Your morning. But I really appreciate you. I feel honored that you selected me to be a guest on your program and to allow me to share my experiences and insight with your guests. And I will definitely do my best to reach out to those individuals and see what information that I can get for you.
For sure. MissBlackExpat.com. Go to the website, check out the YouTube channel, leave a comment, let her know you heard her on the cows, and support the effort. Enjoy the rest of your, I guess for you it's Wednesday evening, enjoy the rest of your week, and we'll definitely be speaking with you down the road. Enjoy the rest of your evening.
Thank you so much, and you enjoy your day. Thank you, and be blessed.
Thank you, you too.
Take care. All right, thank you. Okay, you too.
Good evening. Context of white supremacy. Wowee. Make sure I get my time state in. I'm no fan of the early programs. It's it's not quite 12:30 p.m. Pacific time today, Wednesday, November 2nd. I'm no fan of the early broadcast. We started at 10 a.m. Pacific time today. Two thumbs down. I told a listener days ago, if I had my druthers and I didn't think I would totally obliterate our East Coast listening faithful, our program would start at like 10 p.m. Pacific time. That would be like, I think like 1 in the morning East Coast time, but we would start really late. I am a night person and I do not do mornings at all. But you know, getting folks in, I think, is so important to talk to black people in particular, non-white people on the whole, and even whites from different parts of the world, just to see the global dynamics of white supremacy racism. I think that's so important that I'm willing to sacrifice a morning to to have conversation. I hope it was constructive. And for the people that listen to the archives, man, you wish you could have tuned in, I think. I guess two quick comments that I would make. Definition for racism. I'm so glad we had a caller who pointed that out over the weekend on our compensatory call-in. Having a definition for racism, it is imperative. And I would say that the sexual dynamic, that I think it's really impossible to grasp the incorrectness of sexual intercourse between racists and victims if you don't have an accurate definition of racism. I've said that for years. That's one of those things that I think comes way down the road. As your understanding of white supremacy racism evolves, then you get it. Then the logic makes sense of what is incorrect about these arrangements. But definition. I thought the dynamics were super important, but just that's something that I think is very important to keep in mind, and why I say consistently, if I'm talking to somebody and I see that they don't have just basics definition of racism, I don't look to get to more advanced things about, you know, why no sex between whites, non-whites, why that is counter-racist logic. The other thing I thought was significant, just global, when you see the same types of power dynamics globally, just many of the things, the colorism that she touched on, fear of whites, us looking up, wanting white validation, us being white identified, just the litany of things that she pointed to, just seemed to be replicated worldwide in the system of white supremacy. Things like that, I think, are important to grasp the enormity of the problem and to begin to see that these whites are not ignorant. They're coordinated. They're not ignorant. They're coordinated. They're doing the same basic types of things worldwide. That's when I think we can really refine our codification when we begin. I think the metaphor that I've heard used is, a lot of times we talk about racism and we kind of have a on the ground view. It's very different when you can start to pull up and get the bird's eye view, when you can get the 10,000 foot view, and then you can pull back even more and get like the 100,000 foot view to really get a grasp, to put things in perspective. I think that's what traveling and or talking to people around the world, I think that's what that can do to your understanding of racism, that and having a historical context for how you view things. Moving forward, if folks have commentary they would like to share, what they heard from the program today, feel free. I just want to get in. We will be here tomorrow, back to the regular time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, Workplace Racism. That's tomorrow, Thursday, normal broadcast. And then Friday, our second session on Lothrop Stoddard, The Rising Tide of Color Against White World Supremacy. Normal time. This is our second session. We just started. So if you missed last week, you can go in the archives, hear the first session, and be ready to roll. Incidentally, if folks are looking for any extra credit work on that, I got a PDF of the transcribed debate between Lothrop Stoddard and W.E.B. Du Bois. Now, this happened very early in the 20th century, 1900s, where they did this debate, Lothrop Stoddard, W.E.B. Du Bois, and the subject of the debate was, shall the Negro be encouraged to seek cultural equality? This took place in March of 1929. I have the PDF I can share. It's not very long. It's like 20 pages, basically. So if you want to read it, we can include that as we discuss Rising Tide of Color. Just let me know. I'm going to upload it to a link that I can easily share, and then I'll just put it on Facebook. I'll put it on Twitter. I might even link it in the description for the episode, so you can just download it, and then we can, it's like I said, it's short. So if you want to read it and add that, I just thought that is amazing. I didn't even know that these two figures debated, much less that it's transcribed, so you can go back and see what they said. I think that is fascinating, and in particular, I think this is the type of study Dr. Francis Cress-Welsing would want us to carry out as we read this text. Right on. If folks have any comments they would like to share, I think we still have our international audience with us, Mr. Fox in the UK, our caller at 0325, retired firefighter, and the female caller at 4130. If any of you all had comments that you wanted to share, feel free. Any observations from what you heard from Miss Black Expat joining us live from Uganda?
Yeah, are we heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I think it was an excellent show. Really good. She gave really great constructive information. I think a lot of stuff she said was really on point with the previous information that we had received from other shows and other, like the international callers and things of that nature. I really did appreciate her information on people, on these white women coming to Uganda, marrying the black males and preying on them and stuff. I really did appreciate that information. That was really good, constructive information. I did want to make a comment, though, about the fact that it does seem to me that, you know, when it comes to black females, even after they start to understand, you know, racism a little bit, you know, they start understanding the system, they still have an issue with trying to break away from, I don't want to say feminist, but like they don't want to admit that white women are, I guess, as bad, as racist as white males, you know? And so sometimes they kind of tend to almost, it sounds almost like they're almost defending white women, you know, I've been trying to think of a way in which try to conversate with black females and trying to, because in my conversation with them, you know, I found that they don't really understand that white females, you know, are racist. I mean, they think a white male power structure, but not white, you know, white women. And, you know, if anyone on the call has any tips on how to actually better, you know, help black females to understand that white women are racist too and practice racism as well. If not more so, and maybe even, you know, more effectively than white males. And I'll mute my line. Thank you, Gus, for having this early show. I appreciate it, and thanks for having the guests. It was great.
Glad you were able to chime in, sir. I would just say it's been my experience that it is not anything that is restricted to black females. I personally know a lot of black males who also have a tendency to leave out or minimize the role of racist woman in maintaining the empire of terrorism. Some of the suggestions that I have resist or call out when people talk about racism and say the problem is the man or the white man, or the white man is going to do this, resist that and include white man, white woman. I would do racist man, racist woman, racist child to make sure that she is not left out and that we're not exclusively focusing on racism or suggesting that racism is just a problem with white men. Point out examples when white women are the ones who are practicing racism or who are also equally involved in acts of racism. That's something I try to do as well. They just had the situation with Cynthia Whitlatch here in Washington, where this was a white female police officer, no less, who terrorized a black male senior. I believe he was in his 70s, where he has his civil lawsuit against her and the Seattle Police Department that's going on right now, where she had called black people nigger on her social media feed, amongst other things. The case that happened down in Florida where the white female teacher was calling First Lady Michelle Obama a gorilla, and those sort of, just as many examples as you can of white women where they are the ones. So people can't just consistently and kind of in a cliche manner blame white males. I think that also is very helpful. And again, just fundamentals of what it means to be a white person. I think that helps too. Other people that we haven't heard from, did you have comments or responses you wanted to add?
Sorry, just to
We'll nab our female caller first.
Hi, I just wanted to comment towards
the statement about white women and non-white women. And I believe my mother is white. I am mixed race. And I would agree that black women do tend to give white women the benefit of the doubt. A lot of my father, who is white, who is black, excuse me, a lot of the female family members of his consider or make statements regarding my mother as, she's really black on the inside because my mother adopted certain traits of black culture, so she was able to effectively infiltrate my father's family. But I strongly, strongly believe that the definition of racism is what is causing the biggest confusion. Before I became a listener of Cal's, I was confused myself, obviously, being raised mostly by a white mother. She separated from my dad and kept us away from him as possible. And I believe that it was the definition of racism that made me realize and reflect back on my childhood. And now that I can think about it and now that I have a true definition, I can say that every single day of my life, my mother practiced white supremacy against me. And I'll beat my wife.
Wowee. Fascinating. No, folks will be giddy about hearing more details from that. I did want to point out, because you echoed the previous caller's point about the black females being duped, it would seem that your race soldier of a mother also duped your black father, yes?
Absolutely. Now that I have a definition of racism, I definitely agree that diluting the black man's seed is a direct act of white supremacy.
Fascinating. We will, I guess, go in order. Mr. Fox, since he's our international caller, did you have commentary you wanted to add, sir?
I did, but I forgot what I was going to say now, so you might have to come to me later if you can.
We will swing back around to you. I'm sure it'll come back to you. The other person that was going to comment, was that retired firefighter?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Oh, okay. To the question, I was just thinking that the general direct violence perception may make a difference. And I put asterisk on perception that, white females don't engage as much as white males in direct violence, the use of direct violence in order to maintain the global system of race and white supremacy. That may, so to speak, provide a confusing perception to non-white black females, although there are some vicious white females that I'm pretty sure a lot of people on this program can come up with, but from the difference of from a long historical standpoint, they kind of like sat in the background and gained the advantage of the direct violence that their white male counterpart has. But nevertheless, they were the first teachers. They were the ones who taught the male the strategy, that sort of thing, so to speak. It's one of the reasons why. It's not the whole reason why, but it's one of the reasons why, I think. I think the program was pretty informative. I also thought the guest did also humble herself and listen based on the logic that was transferred or shared with her. I really appreciate that when non-white people, especially non-white black people, are talking and a non-white black person says or asks a question that is logical, and the instead of the other non-white black person just saying, "I disagree," just to be disagreeable, they actually think about it. And she actually did that at least two or three times that I noticed in the program, and I applaud her on that. And I think it was a good program in that way also. Thank you.
Humility is a real important and understated aspect of counter-racism, in my opinion. Hopefully something that is demonstrated on this program regularly, hopefully.
Yeah, just one important, what I thought was examples, when you brought up the power dynamic that makes a difference, that only a white person under the global system of white supremacy can practice racism. And she thought about it because it made logical sense to her. And she may have never heard it expressed in that way, but she was humble enough to identify logic. Thank you.
Absolutely. Real important aspect as well. Mr. Fox, did your thought come back to you, or you need a little bit more time?
No, I just like to say, I will have to agree with the firefighter. It was a really good broadcast, and I hope she does actually do these interviews with the white ladies in tragic arrangements with Ugandan locals. Regarding the white women and how we always felt to see them as being just as racist as white males, especially when it comes to tragic arraignments and the white females being accepted into the black families, a lot of the time, all the time being in the UK, a lot of them get passes and they just automatically get brought into the family, zero suspicion. They're just... they're given a lot of leeway as well, but we always fail to see them as just as bad as white males. It's like, to use a metaphor, it's like a male lion and a lioness, they're both deadly, but we always see the white woman being the lioness, we always see her as being a kitty cat, when we actually see the white male as being the most dangerous threat, when really they're both as dangerous as each other and work together. Sorry to use a metaphor, but that's how I see it. I'll mute my line.
Absolutely. Again, and that's why I think it's so important in terms of pointing out real life illustrations when whites are practicing racism, and to point it out as such correct terms. So we're not saying that they were being ignorant or stupid, that no, this white person was practicing racism, and even picking out historical patterns where white women have practiced racism. Margaret Sanger, we can pick out authentic historical figures, and even, you know, worldwide in the broader scope, Margaret Thatcher, since we got UK representation on, picking out, you know, major ways that white women have contributed to the global war effort of white supremacy. I think that's a big help as well, where they're not just confined to the margins to come out and, you know, cry on cue and point an accusing finger at a raping nigger, that they do 70%. Now, she did. I did think that was significant, because she said in her school system over there, particularly as you get into the upper levels, that it seems like it's mostly white males. Now, that is, you know, quite a difference from the states and other areas where it's mostly white women who are doing the damage in public school systems. But they are integral component to the global system of white domination. I'll put it that way. Other folks have comments they were going to get in?
Sorry, can I just add one more thing?
Yes, sir.
Just the similarities with the white women going over to Uganda in the 21st century, and then earlier in the 19th century, when we actually go back to the autobiography of Malcolm X, there was a part in that where he states, where obviously this is the height of segregation, but still there was the police section of the town where he was from in the South, where at a certain time of night,
the Polish women would come over to the black side of town. I can't remember what part that was in the book, but I remember it from the audio section. But that still goes on. Still, if it's in the early 19th century to the 21st of to the 21st century, but that's still, that same dynamic is still there.
Absolutely. I think that might have been when he was in the Michigan area in Lansing. I could be in error, but if that was the early portion of the book, I'm thinking that might be Michigan he was describing, where they would come to the black part of town and, you know, do a little slum dwelling and then, you know, go back to practicing racism the next day. That's, you know, pretty standard operating procedure worldwide. It has been for a long time. I was almost on the verge, and I was going to say this while she was here. I was not waiting for the guest to depart so then I could make my comment. But she amended her statement to the last question about, you know, would it be more accurate to say that the black male, that this was a mutual exploitation, where the black female was, you know, getting some money from this white Russian, and the white Russian was exploiting a, you know, no good African female that he despised anyway. She said no, she thought it was exploitation when she amended her response. I was almost going to say that her responses sounded a little different when it was the Ugandan females with white men as opposed to white women with Ugandan males. I was almost going to ask her about that to see if I was just hearing things or a little off. It seemed like there was a little, at least initially, it seemed like there was a little less sympathy for the Ugandan males who were involved in this. But then she kind of amended her statement, so it sounded a bit more symmetrical. Then am I talking crazy? Did anybody else get that sense, or am I just, I might have?
Yeah, I got that sense. That's the reason why I made my comment about that. Not like I said, I wasn't necessarily picking on women per se, but I think that tendency happens to kind of be there. Not that it's like I think the retired firefighter is spot on with the fact that males, you know, practice like a violence, like it's really violent, and it's, you know, and women, I think women can see that violence, but when it's women and what Mr. Fox said with the lioness thing, I think that plays into it. And Gus, thanks for, you know, giving some tips on, you know, just trying to point out that, you know, there are these different situations where the white women in the news and things of that nature have, you know, exactly. But you're right. You were not imagining that. I do think that was right. Mm-hmm.
There have been programs, I guess, I could pick out as well where we focus more on the role that white women have played. I think some of the earlier programs that we did this year, Melissa Stein, that's one where she talked about the role of white women in lynching in earlier eras of white supremacy, supporting the eugenics movement and other draconian measures to keep black people in check. Like, I think just that, so just pointing out the historical record and right now ways that white women are involved in things that they do to practice racism, I think that's huge. But did anybody else want to respond to whether or not Gus was just being a little loony with his listening skills and the difference in how the tragic arrangements were discussed, or anything else folks want to get in before we wrap up? Folks all satisfied? If everybody's good, that is great too.
Hey Gus.
Yes, sir.
If the female caller is still on the line, I mean, I would like, before you wrap up, I would like there to at least, you know, say a couple of. She said that her white mother practiced racism every day of life. She could just give a couple examples of that. I mean, I think that would be helpful as well. Thanks.
See you there. Super popular, everyone's favorite topic. Ma'am, are you still with us?
Yes, I'm still with you guys. One of the more obvious examples, referring to my siblings and I as her little nigglets, I'm also the most, I am the least melanated of my siblings. There was obvious favor shown towards me for that. There were always comments about how my hair was quote-unquote better than my sister's. Another, I think, really significant instance is as an adult, I began to build a relationship with my father, who's a non-white black male, and I began to embrace my non-white side. And when that occurred, and I guess once she recognized that, there was a lot of just mental and verbal abuse, especially referencing my relationship with non-black men. There was usually a statement made, oh, well, he's not shit just like your father, and, you know, certain things like that. Schools, I think that she intentionally enrolled me in not necessarily failing schools, but schools that were not the best. We lived in a decent area. There was a better funded school in our area. She had the choice of choosing between two. She chose the lesser funded school, I guess you could say. Lots of things are running through my brain, so it's kind of hard for me to shuffle through everything. But I can say that definitely a lack of acknowledgement for health issues of mine. I have asthma. There was very little care or knowledge towards my illness given to me. Another thing, withholding information. The only, I guess you could say, type of speech that she gave me, or the only thing that she taught me as a parent, is to how not to conceive. There was no lesson on personal hygiene or puberty. My hair was never done. That was left up to me. I was left alone at home by myself at a very young age. I want to say around 8 was when she started leaving me home by myself. I was never allowed to socialize. Just the bulk of it was verbal and mental abuse.
Wowee. That is pretty detailed for folks. Hopefully, if we are not wasting your time, and if you're getting any constructive information, if you are able to dial back in, either a workplace, I think you called in for workplace racism last week, correct?
Yes, I think that was about 2 weeks ago. Yes, that's correct.
Right on. If you have the time, if it's worthy of your time and energy, perhaps in the future you dial back in as you ponder more on it, if you feel like sharing some other reflections from your experience, childhood, things that your mom did, the dynamics of that. I'm sure folks, as I stated, that is folks' favorite, by far, favorite area of people activity, hands down. If you think of other things, feel free to share. Even I'm sure if you wanted to write something out, I'm sure a lot of folks would love to read it and comment. I will assume folks are satisfied. Everybody got in everything they needed to say. Spectacular. We will be here tomorrow evening for Workplace Racism, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. If you have questions, comments, suggestions, gripes or complaints, feel free to drop an email untiljustice@gmail.com. untiljustice@gmail.com. We'll try to respond. We got this program, made it happen, and this didn't even come in to our Gmail account. The guest suggestion, they posted it on Facebook. We were still able to make it happen. With that, thanks for the folks who were able to tune in. If you're listening to the archives, drop us an email or what have you. If you have comments on the program, hopefully we can try to get her back on. I'm super hoping she's able to get some of the whites who are either in tragic arrangements or who have abducted Ugandan children. She can do an interview with them. Great. If she could get them on the program, that would be great as well. I was even thinking the Russian parent. But anyway, yeah, hopefully we can get her back on the program as well. So if you listen to the archives, feel free to drop an email if you have thoughts, observations on the broadcast. I guess I'll give, this will be one listening exercise. Either you can rewind if you're listening to the archives or for people if you have a good memory. I think there was a part where we were talking, she was talking about white people in general, and she reverted back to the States. She was going to talk about white people in the States, I thought, and she stopped. And she said, I'm rambling, and she stopped her response, and we continued with the program. I was excited at first because when she said it seemed like he was making kind of a general statement about her experience based her interactions, her contact with whites. And she was going back to the States, but she stopped. I think that might have been one of those moments where the fear of white people, where I might get in trouble if I say that. This is public. It is being recorded. I might want to retract that statement, or, you know, before I've even said it, retract it. You might have to go back in the archives to remember the exact spot I'm talking about. If you recall it, I thought that might have been a moment where the power that whites wield caused her to edit and not say that. And I'm not saying it's nothing wrong with that. I do that. That's the system of white supremacy. I mean, you certainly want to be careful, or you want to carefully consider things that you are saying publicly, particularly if it's going to be directly about whites. That's logical. I'm just saying that I thought it was interesting. If anybody remembers that moment, I didn't think so, but if anybody remembers that moment, that'll be it.
Yeah, sorry.
Oh, okay.
I did. Sorry, I thought you.
Oh, okay. Right on. Did you have the same assessment as I did, or did you think something else was happening, that she might have been self-editing to make sure she didn't get too radical in her critique of white folks?
Self-editing, but then what you just said now, I think it was the fear. And white people do have that, because bearing in mind, if the wrong people hear this or, you know, see it in some type of way, then, you know, her experience in Uganda could be cut short.
Absolutely. And she is a single black mother, so she does have a child to think about as well, going through customs and international flights and all that. But yeah, listening exercise. If you missed that part, you can rewind and listen and, you know, come to your own conclusion. I certainly could be in error. I'm just speculating. That's what I surmised hearing it one time and making a quick judgment that could be an error. But check it out for yourself. Come to your own conclusions. With that, we will wrap things up. Thanks for the folks who tuned in. We will catch you guys in, I guess it's like 36 hours for Mr. Fox. It is evening in the UK, close to 9 p.m. Hope you have a great rest of your Wednesday evening, Grand Thursday. For the rest of folks, it is still pretty early. It's just a little afternoon here, so we will see how the rest of Wednesday plays out. Try to be constructive. We are 1 week away from the election. I did mean to ask her about the election, but just got bogged down. 1 week away from the presidential election. Either way, it will all be over, and I am ecstatic. I'm just glad and tired of hearing about all of it, but that'll all be done a week, well, not even a week. 6 days, that'll all be done, and we can move forward. We'll know what the deal is going to be, and we can move forward with our lives. With that, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Say that consistently. We want to make sure that our behavior at all times reflects the fact that war is being waged against non-white people, particularly black people, and we need to make sure that our brain computers are in optimal condition at all times to make the best decisions, try to keep ourselves as safe as possible, particularly if you're going to be in a vehicle. You never know when today is going to be the day that you bump into Daniel Holtzclaw, Darren Wilson, any of these other race soldiers. White person with a badge or no is dangerous. It can be a life-ending encounter in a matter of minutes. Take it seriously. I do not think the record has shown that alcohol, cigarettes, cannabis, or any other narcotics, drugs have helped us solve this problem. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim. I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.